Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 13, 1996.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good morning. Good evening, I suppose, in many areas. Many time zones from the Hawaiian and Tahitian Islands on eastward, flyover country, that's us, to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Good morning out there. South into South America, north, well, to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, and boy, do I have a good show for you this morning. I've got a lot planned. We've got a heavy hitter here. Much like last night's show, only not. Richard Berenson is here. He has a resume about 2 pages long, and I'll give you a little idea of what he's all about. 1962, he was Geophysics Corporation of America staff scientist. 2 to 4, he was a staff scientist with Ling Temco Vought. 1964, Harvard Project Physics, staff writer for them. Going up, lectured in at Harvard. Acting Chairman, Department of Astronomy at Boston University, Associate Professor, Assistant Professor, and Lecturer in Astronomy there at Boston University. A consultant to the National Academy of Sciences. Whew, there's a lot here. A consultant to the American Council on Education. Associate Professor on leave, Boston University, the American University. President and Professor. A NASA Headquarters Consultant. A professor of physics on leave at the American University, professor of physics again at the American University, and on and on. He belongs to just about, is a member in and belongs to just about every science organization that we have on Earth, I think. He specializes in education and science communication, astronomy, space science, space exploration, the history of science, demographics and workforce planning, management and administration. Very nice resume. Man has about done it all. He is a professor of physics. He is something of an astronomer. All-around kind of guy on space with a view different than you heard yesterday on the program. Then at 2 a.m. Pacific time, we've got yet another physics kind of guy, Stanton Friedman, all the way from New Brunswick, about 4 time zones east of where I am right now. Stanton just got back from Brazil, and those of you who have been following the news on the internet about what has occurred in Brazil will know what this is about. As a matter of fact, Professor John Mack was also there. And so we will indeed talk with Stanton Friedman at 2 a.m. So it's going to be a physics-loaded night. Tomorrow night, Major Dames from SciTech. So we've got a lot lined up for you, as you can see. And that is what's coming up on the show this morning. I want to remind everybody that we have got all of these, well, in fact, the entire scientific report, along with photographs, electron scanning microscope photographs, and graphs of the spectrography done on the parts that I received, purportedly from Roswell. It is getting increasingly interesting. It's all up on my webpage, so if you want to see the science that is being done, the careful, step-by-step science, you're welcome to go take a look. My webpage is www.artbell.com. www.artbell.com. All of that coming up in a moment. Here we go, everybody. This should be fascinating. Coming to us all the way from, I'm not sure where he is. It is Dr. Richard Berenson. Doctor, where are you, in Washington?
I'm in Northern Virginia. I'm looking out my window right now at the dome of the U.S. Capitol.
Uh-huh, the very seat of power. Well, wonderful, and it's, of course it is after 2 a.m. back there, so I understand you're a night person?
Well, I am. This is pushing it, but yes. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you. I just absolutely love this kind of topic, as my audience well knows. You have done just about everything under the sun, it looks like to me, and a little more. What led you into the life of science?
You know, when I was a child growing up in Dallas, Texas, the skies, in fact, are big and bright there, as I know they are where you live. You go out at night, it's pretty awe-inspiring. You look up and can see 4,000 or 5,000 dots of light, and as a youngster, I wondered, what are they? And so I'd ask teachers and others, what are they? And they'd say, well, go read a book. So I did, and ended up majoring in physics as an undergrad and then astrophysics in grad school.
Uh-huh. Well, you're right about our skies out here. They are incredible. And the people in cities now, particularly those troubled with air problems, and that's a lot of them, don't really know anymore what the real sky is like, do they?
They really do not, and I think most Americans do not. Certainly most of the people on the East Coast don't, and most Americans in any urban area do not because of light pollution. We all hear about air pollution, but light pollution is an equal problem. We do not have our lights oriented properly. We put out vastly more light than is needed for safety, security, or just getting around at night. And so what we're really doing is fogging the sky and depriving ourselves and our children of the opportunity of seeing the wonders of what's really out there. I remember driving once across West Texas by myself late at night, and I noticed how beautiful the sky was. I stopped, got out of the car, standing there as the breeze was blowing across around 11 p.m., and I saw a whitish blur, and I thought, that's a strange-looking cloud. Then I realized what it was. It's the Milky Way. And so like the ancient peoples of thousands of years ago, I stood there in awe and looked up at what we now, of course, know is literally hundreds of billions of unresolved stars. It makes you wonder what people centuries ago must have thought and wondered and how fascinating it truly was to them.
I bet they wondered the same things that I wonder when I look at that site, and that is, are we ever going to get to one of those stars? I mean, we don't yet travel faster than light, and presumably, unless we're willing to donate generations into space travel, unless we can do that, we're not going to get there, or are we?
Well, it's pretty frustrating. The laws of nature, as given to us by Einstein and others, seem, in fact, inviolate. We simply cannot go faster than the speed of light, and I think the evidence for that is quite compelling. Now, given the distances to the nearest stars even, which are the order of many light years, if we were to have a rocket that was to travel at, let us say, 90% the speed of light, it would require a prodigious amount of energy and yet require a very long time to do it. So I'm afraid it will be a long, ambitious journey. But I hope that we can take at least the first steps. You know, how will the history books, assuming people are still around 1,000 years from now, record our century? Here, for the first time in human history, we step off of our planet, gently, feebly, to the nearest neighbor, to the moon, and then we retreated back, sort of like a child stepping into the cold ocean and running home again.
Yes.
It's a curious sort of retreat, and I hope that eventually we'll have the will, stamina, and the money to go back to the moon, this time to stay, and then ultimately go on with robots and finally with human beings to Mars, and I think maybe even before Mars, to asteroids.
What is your best estimation of why we sort of did as you suggested? We went to the moon several times, and then we sort of said, oh, well, we've been there, we're not going back, and we haven't been back, and it's been, what, 30 years plus, better than, and how come?
Oh, politics and money. I mean, why did we go? We went because it was the Cold War, and the United States and the Soviet Union were the only two remaining superpowers following World War II, and we were clinched in this tight adversarial position in the 50s. They beat us into space. We were stunned to find that they had that kind of technical prowess. We scrambled to catch up. Didn't seem that we could, and eventually we did. The leader of the space program in the Soviet Union died, which ironically helped us. We had von Braun and his crew here, which helped us. We had the technology, the electronics, the computers, and then it was a political decision on the part of President Kennedy, because after all, he had suffered the embarrassment of the Bay of Pigs and other problems. And So despite all the odds, he said, we're going to go to the moon. And then, of course, he was assassinated. And it became almost a national need to fulfill the pledge of the now fallen president. So we did get there, and it was one of the landmarks in the history of humankind. But it was at the same time as the Vietnam War and a host of other problems, and so we lost interest after a time.
All right. There is a recent story. I've got a copy of the Philadelphia Inquirer here. And astronomers report they have discovered a solar system far closer to our sun than any of the previous half dozen planet discoveries. Moreover, the new planetary system has features strikingly similar to our own, and it's not apparently that far away, about a little better than 8 light years. What would that mean, assuming we can't break the speed of light, 8 light years? How long, then, would it take us to get there?
Well, a light year is the distance light travels in a year, and 186,000 miles per second, so it would take us literally 8 years, or 8.1 years, if we could manage to go that fast. And, of course, we can't go that fast. The fastest thing that humankind has ever launched was the Galileo probe, which plunged into the upper atmosphere of the planet Jupiter on December 7th of last year. It was traveling at about 108,000 miles per hour at the time. Not because we launched it that fast, but rather because of the gravitational tug of Jupiter. So we can't get anywhere even remotely close to that kind of speed. So I'm afraid it's going to be a long trip. But this discovery, if it turns out, in fact, to be real, and it needs now to be confirmed, if so, it's really quite impressive and very exciting, because the object is astronomically right in our backyard. It is a star not dissimilar from the sun, and the planetary system might be something similar to our own.
If life had evolved there, surely we should have, by now, heard radio or television or something. 8 light years is not that far, and surely our signals are bombarding their system. Would that not be so?
No, that's absolutely a fact. In fact, it's one of the sobering realities of our time that the principal way that intelligence on this planet is known off of the planet is not through the great writings of our religions or of Shakespeare or the science of Einstein or Newton. It's because of television, which is seeping out. So Ricky Lake becomes our interstellar emissary.
Huh. Well, at least they'd get some of the early stuff, Ozzy and Harriet and some of the early shows.
That's
first,
right,
I presume.
Exactly. Jackie Gleason and all the rest of that. Well, with respect to our picking up a signal from out there, we'd have to assume that their life forms began at about the same time ours did, that their star began at about the same time ours did. Our sun is approximately 4.6 billion years old in a universe that many of us think is of the order of 12 to 15 billion years old.
Right.
And so it's a second generation star. Now, we don't know what generation star that one is out there, and we're not sure of its age, but estimate that it's in the ballpark of the sun's. But we don't know enough about the planets. If the planets formed at about the same time that ours did, then the question is whether or not our evolutionary rate here on Earth is typical of elsewhere. And, of course, we only have one case study, and that's here on Earth, so we just don't know.
What are the odds? I'm going to ask it the other way around. What are the odds that we are alone?
Well, I have been one of the people for a long time who's been saying that in the vastness of our enormous universe, given all the multitudes of astronomical objects that we know about, to assume that we are the only beings that have ever been or could ever be seems to me preposterous. It's just difficult to imagine. Now, it is possible, however, that life could have arisen elsewhere and not have become intelligent enough to communicate off of its planet. There are a number of biologists who point out that out of the billions of species that have come into being on our planet, as far as we know, only one, human beings, are capable of communicating off of the planet. Chimpanzees and dolphins and whales and many have their own languages, but they can't communicate off the planet. So if those kind of odds apply elsewhere, even if there is life, communicating with it might be very difficult.
Do you consider,
but of course, we're just extrapolating.
Sure. Do you consider it possible that intelligent life could or would form without forming what we know of as an industrial scientific civilization? In other words, at some level, they could form and simply never find a need nor a want for that sort of thing and exist differently.
Oh, it certainly is imaginable. With the only case study we know, as I said, is human beings, and we know our own progress, and we know how we slowly, torturously started in Babylonia and then with the Greeks and went through our long period of silence in the Dark Ages or Middle Ages, and then eventually we rose again and then finally came to the Industrial Revolution and so on. Now, whether or not that's the story elsewhere, who's to say? The first question is whether or not there are viable stars or planets around likely stars, and increasingly astronomers are finding that the pieces of the puzzle are coming together. We know that there are multitudes of stars out in space, not dissimilar from our own sun. So without being overly chauvinistic about the Earth, if we want to be highly conservative and only look for life sites somewhat similar to our own, and assume that the life is forming on a planet, and who's to say, maybe it could form in a cloud or elsewhere, but assuming that it forms on a planet, are there planets out there? A year ago, no one could have said definitively, but now we can, because at least a half a dozen have been found, and bear in mind, the planets are only about 1/1,000,000th as bright as their stars, so they're terribly hard to see. By the turn of the century, we're going to find dozens.
Yes, I would imagine we would. And would you say these discoveries affect the numbers? Everybody's always playing with the numbers. In other words, there are the likelihood is there are planets around X number of stars. That would mean the following and the following and the following. Now that we know that planets seem fairly likely, that would seem to raise the odds that there would be life that could evolve on one of them.
Well, it does, Art. Of course, what we don't have yet are enough statistics. We don't have enough findings to provide real data. We can't say what the likelihood of a star having a planetary system is. We just don't know. But I think within 10 to 20 years, we will know.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine the astronomy books of the year 2010 are going to say roughly 40% or whatever of all stars have planetary systems, and then we will begin to accumulate data about what those planets might be like. My guess is that there are multitudes of small planets of the order of the Earth. The first ones that we've discovered have been the big guys, the big Jupiters, which is just what you'd expect because
sure.
They're bigger, more massive, they tug in their stars better. But all the little rubble-like things like Earth, which is terribly important to us but nonetheless small, will be a harder search.
You either consulted or have been part of the SETI program, haven't you?
Right. Mm-hmm.
SETI has gone through some evolution with government funding and then no government funding. What I'm wondering, Doctor, is if there is life out there and there are feeble signals coming from someplace or another, how good are the odds that SETI, as it is presently configured, might find something?
Terribly hard to know. The first question is where to look, which means what candidate stars might you look at. Next, do those stars have planetary systems? And we're beginning to give pretty good answers to those questions. The next question is radio the rational mode of communication? It certainly seems to be to us, because after all, it's part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It
That's
is
right.
Light itself. It travels at the maximum possible speed of nature. It's easy to generate. It's easy to transmit. It's easy to receive. It is not blocked by most of the things out in the universe. It seems like a uniquely rational mode of transportation. On the other hand, maybe we are temporally chauvinistic. Maybe this reflects the fact that we live in this century. Maybe people 1,000 years from now would say, oh, heavens, no one would use radio. What we use are gamma rays. But if for a moment we don't jump to that and we stick with radio because we know it works, we know that nature itself emits radio waves, 21 centimeter lines, for example, of hydrogen, where then do we look and how do we look? Next comes our biggest challenge of all, the tough one, and this is the one that is almost never mentioned in books or articles, and that is when to look. And by when, I don't mean whether it's 10 o'clock tonight or 11:30 tomorrow morning. I mean, should we look in 1996, or should we have looked in the year 1700, or in the year 3000? Because the universe is so old, so big, and the distances are so great, we have to realize the time spans become enormous. It could be that the Earth was bathed in loud, clear, unmistakable signals from intelligent beings, even on planets around the star that was just studied, the one that you mentioned. That
back in the 1700s, say.
Exactly. And there was intelligence all over Earth, but they didn't have radio telescopes.
obviously, most of the important work in this area then is going to go on with radio telescopes as opposed to the optical, even the Hubble.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The problem with optical light is that you cannot transmit it over vast distances of the galaxy. It's blocked too easily by gas and dust and the galactic plane, whereas radio is not. You also have all kinds of problems about keeping a collimated beam. Radio is really advantageous over all of those. It's so easy to transmit. So
yes, I've got a question with regard to the possible radio reception when we get back in just a moment.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 13, 1996.
My guest, Dr. Richard Berenson. He's a physicist, something of an astronomer. He's been connected with SETI, and we're talking about that, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. Now to Dr. Berenson. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Doctor, I'm a ham radio operator, so I understand a little bit about the radio spectrum. And the lower frequencies, of course, tend to pretty much bounce off the ionosphere and return to Earth. That which we're on now, AM radio, does it very well at night. Shortwave frequencies do it. And not until you get up, into at least VHF, can you be assured that it'll pass through the ionosphere and keep going out to space. Now, the center of my question here is, what are the most likely frequencies to listen to that would arrive, make it across all this space and make it to Earth? Where would you listen?
Well, where most of the listening has occurred is close to 21 centimeters, which is about 1420 megacycles.
Really?
And the reason for that is that that is where hydrogen, the most abundant element in the universe, has its own natural signal. And so the logic is that if nature is sending a signal in that frequency band, wherever beings happen to be elsewhere in the universe, if they knew as much as we knew, they would surely be aware of that particular radiation. And so it might be sort of a natural beacon throughout the cosmos. With respect to our atmosphere, we have to be very cautious because an atmosphere elsewhere, an ionosphere elsewhere, might be different from ours.
Well, that's true.
And so we have to have sort of a universal mode of communication.
So that would be, 14.2 gigahertz in that area?
That's
very
right.
Interesting.
And tune up and down the dial because you don't know exactly where to look. And the largest, most ambitious undertaking of that sort is now being done at Harvard, and this was privately funded, not government funded. I was the first person to testify before Congress, actually, for government funding of SETI some years ago, and it was, in fact, provided for a time, and then, of course, it's provided and then cut and back and forth, depending on the year. At the present time, it was cut off, as you probably know.
Yes.
In 1992, it was turned on in a major way in the 500th anniversary of the landing of Columbus in this hemisphere, but then just a few months later it was cut off again because of the budget squeeze here in Washington. Well, I'm a member of the board of the Planetary Society, and as you know, we're a very large space-oriented organization, and through private philanthropy, they provided the money so that a team up at Harvard is running what's called the Billion Channel Analyzer.
Mm-hmm.
So it is scanning up and down the radio dial, literally looking at a billion different frequency bands.
Years ago, you'd be the perfect person to answer this, really. There was something called the Brookings Report, and I bet you're familiar with it. If not, in brief, it simply says, if we were contacted or visited by an intelligence greater than ours, and that information got out, that it would so destroy religious scientific paradigms as to cause anarchy. People giving up on faiths, all that sort of crazy thing. What do you think?
I don't buy that kind of thinking at all. First of all, it may or may not be true, and nobody knows, and it's just terribly hard to know because we don't have any case study to compare it with. And by being more advanced, the beings elsewhere might be 1 year more advanced or 1 billion years more advanced. We would not normally carry on a lively conversation with a flatworm, and yet the extraterrestrials could be that much more advanced than we are. Or maybe we're more advanced than they are. If we assume that we're roughly in the same stage of advancement, or maybe they're only 100 years more advanced, would that be utterly traumatizing to us, and would this be something that we should fear?
Just before you answer that, here on Earth, when we have contacted very old peoples, we have generally subverted what culture they have. I don't want to necessarily say we've enslaved them, though in past times we've done that. In other words, greater technological societies have a way of, what's the word I'm searching for, subverting lesser ones. What makes you think that wouldn't happen in this case?
Oh, it could. Or we could be consumed for dinner, or we could be put in a jar, or we could be put in a zoo. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities. Or maybe we would be considered something benign, and they would be advanced enough to where they would not be so bellicose as we and our earthly tendencies tend to be. I just don't know. But with respect to fearing something from elsewhere, one of the things that astronomers, I think, seem to relish a great deal, and I participate in this too, is warning the American people about the potentiality of real doom and disaster. When the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, for example, plowed into Jupiter a couple of years ago, many of us pointed out that that could, in fact, have occurred here on Earth, and indeed has, in past, occurred here on Earth. And that's probably what led to the end of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
What they call the KT event.
Exactly. And the evidence for that now, I think, is compelling, including even probably the location of the crater where the largest object hit the Earth, and that's off the Yucatan in Mexico. Well, the Earth is hit every day, right now, even while we're talking, by small objects, and sometime, probably within the next 10 years or so, will be hit by an object large enough to impart as much energy as the Hiroshima bomb. And we hope, of course, that it's going to hit in the ocean or hit in the desert, not close to your desert, but somewhere else,
Sahara,
and not here anywhere close to a human being. The last time was in 1908, and that time it hit in Siberia. Fortunately killed no person because it's very sparsely populated, but it did kill thousands of reindeer. The Earth will be hit by such objects as that. So I point it out only because astronomers point out these kind of potential problems all the time. And I think rather than fear it, it'd be something that we would want to explore.
If Shoemaker-Levy 9, its multitude of pieces, had plowed into the Earth, there would have been no doubt land and sea strikes, mostly sea because we have mostly sea. What would the effect of Shoemaker-Levy 9 hitting Earth have been?
You know, it's really quite interesting about that because we didn't know as early as one day prior to the first impact what it would be. I happened to have been on a national radio broadcast that day, and one of the callers suggested that there'd be no impact at all, that it was really like a ball of gravel and it would just simply disintegrate in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. And I said, well, you may be right or you may be wrong. I don't know. Let's see how compacted this object is. It turned out that that was a fairly small comet that brought enormous damage to Jupiter. Many of the impact sites were larger than planet Earth. Many of them imparted more energy than the total nuclear arsenals of Earth combined. Now, if that had hit the Earth, what would have happened? The first thing that would have happened is acid rain. We know what happens if a large object passes at very fast speeds through the Earth's upper atmosphere. It causes acid rain. So the poor dinosaurs, for example, we think were hit by an object about 6 miles in diameter. Probably first it would be as if huge amounts of battery acid were dumped on your head. And then would have come the fires. And the fires would have been unlike anything that we would have known since. They would have burned not only the trees and the grass, but they would have been superheated, similar to what happened in World War II and the firebombing, for example, in Germany. in which case almost the air itself catches on fire.
Yes.
And then the winds would have picked that up and spread the smoke, which would have then dropped the temperature, broken the food chain, and the poor dinosaurs would have hit it in many different ways, to say nothing of the tidal waves when the chunks hit the water. The tidal waves could have been far taller than the World Trade Center, rushing inland at it several hundred miles per hour. And if you consider the weight of water, that would have been one heck of a mess. We could have had that happen at Shoemaker-Levy 9. It hit us.
Uh-huh. Would anybody survive it? Would any human survive it, deep underground, to rise again like the Phoenix?
Very unlikely. However, we know that when the dinosaurs were hit, if our theories on that are right, and I really think the evidence is pretty strong on it, roughly half of the species on Earth were killed. The big ones, the big dinosaurs. But on the other hand, about half survived. Cockroaches survived. Nothing can kill a cockroach, apparently.
Apparently.
And they are the little guys that sort of burrow down, and they didn't need the food chain that the large dinosaurs did.
Mm-hmm. So then what about those who theorize, and there are many now doing it, that man has been here not just this time, but previous times, and that Earth is very old indeed, and that man may have come and gone, or some version of man, any number of times. Possible?
Well, I suppose it's possible. A lot of things are possible. The question is, what is the strong evidence? And I have not seen evidence that's compelling in that. I don't presume to be an expert in anthropology or archaeology, but I certainly read about those subjects, and I teach history of science, and the story that I think that we generally present is certainly a very beautiful one, and it seems to me to have good documentation that the universe began about 12 to 15 billion years ago. Our sun is probably a second, maybe a third generation star, so that some of the elements in the sun and in the earth and indeed in our own bodies were made in the interior of stars now long dead. Mm-hmm. We could not be alive except for the fact that another star died, and today we are made of its material. The director of the Harvard Observatory once said, "We're brothers of the boulders and cousins of the clouds." Mm. Indeed we are. As for the origin and evolution of civilization, we think we're getting closer and closer to that. It appears that given the atmosphere and the early conditions of planet Earth, when acted upon by radiation from the sun and volcanism and radioactive decay and electrical discharge in the atmosphere, we think probably you could have formed the pre-biological molecules necessary in the Earth's oceans to have led to the life. Is that miraculous or is it not? Well, I think it's pretty extraordinary. If you want to call it a miracle, that's no quarrel with me. In any case, it would have come about, and as far as I know, have arisen only once.
Okay. You take the traditional position that there was what is known as the Big Bang.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to ask some silly questions about this, I guess. Number one, I take it the Big Bang was a very, very dense ball of matter surrounded by virtually empty space. And a physicist I had on last night, I asked him a question. He said, it's a very troubling question for physicists. What was before the Big Bang? Just emptiness?
No, nothing. I think the answer of the modern cosmologist is that there was no time before the Big Bang. You know, intuition tells you that time has existed forever, that it's infinite and it had no beginning. But stop and consider that, challenge that assumption for a moment.
All right.
There are only two possibilities. Either time is infinite or it had a beginning. And if it's infinite, that in itself is quite a jolting commentary. Can you think of anything else that's infinite? Probably not. What we are beginning to conclude in cosmology today is that the Big Bang was literally the beginning of everything. And what we therefore have to do is divorce ourselves from what we're naturally inclined to do, and that is to make a human-like analogy. Mm-hmm. And what we're inclined to think of is a huge room, like a giant auditorium. And in that auditorium, there is an enormous blast, like a huge dynamite cap going off,
mm-hmm.
In which case you can logically ask what happened a second before the explosion. If, however, the modern cosmologist is right, there was no space and there was no time before that explosion. Why would there be no time? because Einstein taught us that space and time are indelibly linked together. If there was no space, there was no time. Was there any space? Did the explosion then throw material out into space? No. What we think is that the Big Bang brought forth space and time together, and what has been expanding ever since has been both. So
right.
Time has been continuing and space has been expanding.
Could you say then that without mass to measure and without point A to point B to measure to, there could be no time?
That would be basically true.
So there was just sort of a dark, infinite
nothing. You can't even have darkness without the absence of light. There was literally nothing. Now, if you want to say, from a theological point of view, there was God, there were the laws of nature, there was something supreme, something beyond human intellect, I certainly would not disagree about that, and many scientists, in fact, would agree and believe it on the basis of faith, but nobody can prove it one way or another.
But your best take on it is that there was divine intervention of some sort?
Well, if you ask me now, as an individual, as a person, I happen to think that the laws of nature are so beautiful, so exquisite, they work so magnificently, and I've seen the images of the distant objects and how beautiful they are. And by the way, just a few hours ago, we've now gotten new images showing the birth of stars wrapped in this birth cloth of gas and dust.
Oh, I've seen them.
Oh, they're just awe-inspiring.
They are. They really are. I've never in my life seen anything like those photographs.
Isn't that something? It's
yes.
Very difficult for me to look at that and think it's just random, absolute chance. But that's a personal point of view. So, yes, I do believe that there is some higher form than I understand. And if you wish to call it God, that's fine.
Okay. I've got a story here that basically says astronomers are now puzzled by the age of stars, and they seem to have found some stars that are 1 to 1.5 billion years older, they say, than the universe itself ought to be. And under the model that you have described, that would be impossible.
It sure would, and this is illustrating what, to some non-scientists, appears to be a real problem in astronomy, and there's therefore something wrong. I look at it the other way around. I see it as a real opportunity for astronomy and physics. In fact, I think it's just terribly exciting. Whenever you come to this kind of strange paradox, what it usually suggests in the history of science is that you're on the verge of a major breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
When you find stars that are older than the universe, obviously there's something wrong. Either we don't have the right age for the universe, we don't have the right age for stars, or both.
Or the Big Bang Theory is simply incorrect.
Well, that's a possibility, although I think the evidence for it is pretty strong. We can talk about that if you want. I think there's several lines of evidence which are very hard to dismiss.
Are you going to talk about the redshift?
Well, the redshift implies that the universe is getting larger. It doesn't necessarily imply that there was a Big Bang. I mean, Fred Hoyle over in England, for example, proposed way back in the 40s that there was a steady state model, that the universe has been around forever and that matter is continuously coming into being.
Yes, that would agree with the man I had on last night.
Yeah, and that was a view that was popular in England and a few other places about 50 or 60 years ago. But I think there is a great deal of evidence to indicate that it is not true. One of the fundamental tenets of that is that what is called the perfect cosmological principle, which says that there was no special point in time. I think many of the people who put forward the idea really dislike the idea of a Big Bang because it has an origin-like sound to it, a Genesis moment, as it were.
Yes.
And they were trying to think of not only a special place in the cosmos, and, you know, since the days of the ancient Babylonians, we've been struggling to find that we here on Earth are not at the center of the solar system. Our solar system's not at the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy's not at the center of the universe. There does not appear to be a privileged place. And so they're arguing there's not a privileged time either. But a couple of problems. Quasars, these astoundingly bright, remarkable objects, are all far away. It is not as if... And therefore very far out in time. It's not as if you can find them nearby and therefore close to us in time. And even worse for the steady state theory was the discovery of the 3K background radiation, made at the Bell Telephone Labs many years ago, which led to two Nobel Prizes when they interpreted it. We have now heard the radiation. We can hear the hiss even today of the explosion that began the universe.
Echoes of the original explosion.
Yeah, if you imagine an explosion of almost unimaginable intensity 15 billion years ago, the universe expands, the radiation, the energy that that explosion led to is still in the universe, but the universe is now vastly larger, then the amount of energy per cubic centimeter would necessarily be lower, the temperature is lower, and it is 3 degrees Kelvin, actually about 2.8, and that's exactly what your radio telescope picks up.
All right, Doctor, you've got about an 8 or 10 minute break. Relax, get a cup of something or another, and we'll be right back to you.
It's a deal.
Dr. Richard Berenson, I presume by now you're getting the idea. There will be more.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 13, 1996.
From the great American Southwest, I bid you good morning. I'm Art Bell. My guest is a brilliant man, Dr. Richard Berenson, and his credentials are 10 miles long. I know some of you are just joining us at this hour, so good morning. You're in for a real treat. Dr. Berenson has consulted with the SETI program. He has been a professor of physics with the American University, consulted with NASA, an associate professor on leave from Boston University, and I could go on and on and on about every award, just about every professional accolade ever given to somebody in his field, has worked with Dr. Carl Sagan. We're going to ask him about that as well in a moment. And I have pulled from him one more hour. I want to remind you that at 2 a.m. Following this segment, we're going to be talking to another physicist way far away, Stan Friedman, in New Brunswick. And he's got a real shocker for you about what he just found, what they just found in South America, in Brazil. He just got back. He'll be here at 2 in about an hour. Now, back to Dr. Berenson. Thank you, Dr. Berenson. I realize I probably put undue pressure on you to get another hour here, shamelessly,
sure.
But you're fascinating. Here are a couple of kind of far-out questions by facts. One is, it is interesting, is it possible that Nostradamus and others in his category, in your view, could possibly see events ahead in time, things that lie ahead for us?
No, I certainly don't think so. I know that there are people who do believe that. There are many books that have been written about it. But what you don't normally hear about are all the predictions that Nostradamus or anyone else made that didn't work.
Right.
What people like to do is to point out things which are rather vaguely stated and then try to interpret it after the fact and say this is what it was referring to, and pick any event at any time, and you can make some sort of a claim.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be an Nostradamus to do that. I can make vague enough statements, and sometime within the next 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, there's going to be something that's sort of going to seem like it. But does that mean I'm seeing the future?
No. And the quatrains, indeed, were sort of vague and seemed to apply to many things. All right, one other question, kind of far out. From a physicist's point of view, what is a ghost?
I don't know. I would personally imagine it's something best answered by a psychiatrist, psychologist, someone else. I don't know. I don't presume to know. I've never studied that, but from what little I do know about it, I've never seen any evidence that there is such a thing. And now, you know, the people who would probably be the most intrigued and love to know that there really are such things would be physicists.
Absolutely.
And so there's nothing intrinsically, philosophically opposed to it. It's just that where's the evidence?
Indeed. I know there have been a number of investigations by prestigious universities that have tried to and have noted some magnetic anomalies and lower temperatures, all that sort of thing, but not enough for scientific repeatability.
No, there really isn't. And for almost all of these things, you can come up with a counter-explanation of why you got what might appear to be an anomalous finding. And by the way, it doesn't occur every time. It doesn't occur the same way for every observer. And therefore, from the standpoint of science, it just isn't real.
Right. Does a black hole slowly and continually grow and grow and grow as mass is sucked into it? Does it actually get bigger?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The famous British scientist Stephen Hawking has done extensive work on that, and your listeners might like to read some of Hawking's material, although it's not easy reading. And there's a fellow at Caltech by the name of Kip Thorne, T-H-O-R-N-E, who's probably the top authority in this country on black holes, and he's written extensively on this as well. What they suggest is that the black hole, once formed, can continue to suck in mass. Will it become larger? Yes, it can become larger, but most importantly, it becomes more massive. For example, at the center of our own galaxy, our Milky Way galaxy, which consists of some 300 billion stars, and this is the band of light that we were talking about earlier,
yes,
we are really quite convinced there is a very massive black hole that could have a mass perhaps a million times that of the sun. Remote quasars, these incredibly bright, distant, rapidly moving objects that we've seen out in the universe, may be devouring the mass of the Earth something like every 5 seconds.
Is it possible that a black hole, after acquiring a certain amount of mass, itself is once again star material? In other words, does it become a recycled sun?
No. If we understand it right, it is simply collapsing essentially out of the cosmos. Imagine taking an object which is perhaps 200 times the diameter of the Earth, millions of times the mass of the Earth, compressing it to the volume of the sun, the volume of the Earth, the volume of the moon, the volume of a city, the volume of a block, the volume of your house, the volume of your room, the volume of your hand, the volume of a dot. Gone. Well, that's very hard for us to accept or to imagine, and it gets a little more complex than that because the clock inside of that black hole is not running at the same rate that our clock is running because of the general relativity that I was mentioning earlier on. But in essence, that's what's happening. Now, what happens is that once you reach this threshold where we can no longer see it, in my personal view, the laws of physics as we understand them break down. And I have many colleagues who go on writing equations and speculating about what's going on inside, and that's fine, and I'm glad they do that. But from my point of view, our laws of nature as we understand them no longer apply, and I'm more inclined just to say, I don't know.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Berenson. Hi.
Hello?
Hello there. Where are you, please?
I'm in Nashville.
Nashville, all right.
Yeah, I'm a Vanderbilt student, and we're talking about something in physics class, a physics class I took a couple semesters ago, about paired photons that I didn't really understand. I was hoping your guest could give me a little better understanding of it. It sounded really fascinating. It's if you split a beam of light, you get two photons that are paired. One's up and one's down. And if you flip one, the other one flips instantaneously, faster than the speed of light. Somehow they one knows the flip. The other one knows the flip. I was wondering if you could explain that.
Well, I'm afraid I really cannot because, first of all, I'm not sure that the phenomenon occurs, but I do not know that much about it. My specialty really is astronomy, cosmology, history of science, and the like, but I have heard of people speculating about such things as this. I think, to the best of my knowledge, this is purely in the theoretical realm at the moment with, again, no experimental confirmation. That's not to say that somebody won't find these kind of things. You know, when people first started talking about quarks years ago, there were a number of people who doubted that you would ever find quarks. Well, now we've found this array of quarks out there, things even more fundamental than electrons and protons.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can find that there are paired photons. I don't know.
All right, more earthly subject. You mentioned Carl Sagan. What is your relationship with Carl Sagan?
Well, he was a brand new young assistant professor at Harvard University, and I was assigned to be his first teaching assistant. He'd never taught before, and I'd never taken the course that he was given, so we made a dynamic duo, but somehow managed to get through it. And we've known each other ever since, and of course he's gone through a difficult time with his health recently, but
yes.
I hope he's coming out of that.
Well, he's a fascinating individual. He must have been, as you said, it must have been an interesting coupling, the two of you. You're both very dynamic.
Well, thank you. He has a wonderful ability to explain a science in a very understandable and engaging way. And then I was professor and head of the astronomy department at Boston University for a time, and Isaac Asimov was on the faculty at BU in the biology and medical school, and Isaac and I used to give a number of lectures together, and so a few times we invited Sagan to join us, and now that was a interesting experience. I couldn't get a word wedged in there, but we would try.
Uh-huh. He has been, and I will ask you about yourself, Dr. Sagan has been at times seemingly rather unfriendly to the UFO crowd.
Oh, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know whether he's unfriendly, but he certainly is not accepting of UFOs, and I think that's true of most astronomers, actually. And I don't personally believe in UFOs. I do believe that there are things sighted in the sky which people don't understand.
Unidentified,
indeed. But 90-95% of them end up being explained, and now there's a residual 5 or 10%. Which some people want to explain in terms of extraterrestrials coming to visit us, but my personal hunch is that fully 100% are explicable in terms of natural, normal, terrestrial phenomena of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm. If we are being watched, and there is always that possibility, that we are being observed by some group, I think if I were up there observing and looking at the social structure down here presently, I wouldn't land.
Maybe not. Is there intelligence on Earth?
Yeah. Let's come back in another 5 million years. These folks might grow up.
Try it later.
Yes. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Berenson. Hi.
It's a pleasure to speak to you. I had two quick questions I'll take off the air. Let me ask them really fast. The first one is about whether interstellar space travel is even possible, no matter what the technology is, when you consider the fact that our galaxy alone is 1,000 light years across. You've got the Great Andromeda Galaxy that's 2 million light years from ours.
Right, it's already been covered, but we'll readdress it.
Well, when you look at those types of distances, even traveling at the speed of light, is it reasonable that you could have that, you can achieve that? And also concerning the planet Mars, there are some scientists that believe that there were great rivers on that planet, even a couple of large oceans on the planet Mars. I'd like to know if you believe that, and if that were true, what do you think happened to get rid of those rivers and oceans?
All right. Very good.
All right. Well, first, with respect to the travel, we talked about that earlier. You might not have heard that discussion, though, but our galaxy, in fact, is not 1,000 light years across. It's 100,000 light years across. Some people suggest 120. So it's really big. And indeed, we cannot go faster than the speed of light, and even to approach it is quite a ponderous feat. So travel among the stars will not be, so far as we know, the way that it's done in Star Trek, where they conveniently go to warp speed. What we would assume is first we will explore our own solar system, but eventually we will send robotic craft. In fact, 4 American-made craft have already left our solar system, as you know. and are traveling now out among the stars, or they will be within a few years as they move further out. You can imagine situations where you actually have human beings aboard spacecraft moving at extraordinarily fast speeds, perhaps using cryogenics, freezing them, keeping them frozen in some sort of state to extend their life expectancy, who knows? Or maybe you have whole generations of people who never live back here on Earth but are born in the spacecraft. They go through their lives. They have their children. They die. Their children continue. Or maybe you build outposts, and it's not a matter of something where you take a trip like flying to Chicago and back, but this is something which is generational in occurring, because it is truly that epic-making in scope, so that it involves literally thousands of years of outward expansion and travel. With respect to your second issue about Mars, yes, there's a great deal of evidence that Mars used to have flowing water. The images which came back from the Viking spacecraft taken in 1976, which was the United States bicentennial, so we sent two spacecraft to land there, and also two orbiters, really provided, I think, very strong evidence that there used to be heavy flooding on Mars. Later this year, there will be three robots sent to Mars, three robotic missions, two American, one Russian, and one of these will involve the first rover ever to land on a planet.
Huh.
It's a cute little thing about the size of a microwave. It has six wheels and a very charming name, I think. We had a contest nationwide to have somebody come up with a name, and a young woman who was 11, I think, in Rhode Island submitted the winning name, and she suggested naming it after the black slave woman in the Civil War in the South, who changed her name and wandered around the South giving lectures about the evil of slavery, and she had changed her name to Sojourner Truth. And so this first robotic rover on another planet will be named Sojourner.
That's wonderful.
And one of the things it'll do will be to drill down about a meter or two and see, in answer to the question, if the water may be in a permanently frozen state there. There are a number of us who think that there could be a permafrost layer down under the visible surface of Mars. Now, if that's the case, that's really quite exciting, because even though Mars is quite a ways from the sun, about 50% further out than the Earth is, and it's therefore rather chilly, about the same as Antarctica here on Earth, realize that life is teeming in Antarctica.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not just talking about the penguins and so on, but there's microbial life forms in abundance there. So you could imagine that a meter or so down underneath the Martian soil, nobody's expecting and finding a little Martian being walking around, but you could have at least primitive prebiotic Martian chemistry going on, and that in itself would be very exciting.
Okay, this leads to begs a couple of other questions. One is, obviously, if there was once water there, as we have it here, flowing, the last thing we would want is to lose our water on this planet. In other words, whatever happened there, could it happen here?
Well, we sure don't, and we now have the benefit of what is called a comparative planetology. This is really a new field. It's only come into being in the last 20 or 30 years. It's arisen because of the exploration of the other planets, and perhaps the most interesting one to consider in that case is not Mars, but rather Venus.
Venus, yes.
Venus, our so-called sister planet, is just about the same mass, about the same radius as the Earth, and it's just a bit closer to the sun than the Earth. But that's where the similarities change. Venus is shrouded in a cloud cover so thick that we can't see through it in visible light to its surface, and that's why it's called Venus, because to our eye it's this soft, beautiful object glowing in the evening sky. It's the goddess of love.
Did it, this goddess of love, globally warm?
It sure as heck did. It got so warm that it's now 900 degrees Fahrenheit on its surface, and your oven only gets to 500 degrees. It is so hot that it would melt lead, and moreover, the atmosphere is so dense above it, it's 90 times the density of ours, 90 bar, so it'd be something like going down into the ocean at 300 feet, and you know what the pressure is if you go to the deep end of a swimming pool. Now imagine going to 300 feet, and it's a pretty obnoxious place.
A true ear-popping experience.
It is. Now, how did it get to that dreadful state? We think that what happened was that in the early days of Venus, there was a volcanism, and the volcanoes blew out carbon dioxide, and they blew out nitrogen, they blew out water, and many other things, and that's what volcanoes typically do.
Mm-hmm.
The water, however, because Venus is close to the sun, broke apart, and the little hydrogen atoms, the lightest elements of all, were moving around so fast that they simply escaped from Venus. And once a planet has lost its water, you can't get it back. It's gone. So the hydrogen is gone. You're left with the oxygen, which can combine with the carbon into the carbonate rocks or to make carbon dioxide atmosphere. And that's how it got this thick, smoggy carbon dioxide atmosphere, which then trapped the radiation under it, the famous greenhouse effect, which heated up the surface even more, pumped out even more of the gases, which led to even more carbon dioxide. It was a runaway greenhouse effect. And that is certainly not a direction we want our own planet to go.
Is that the direction we're going in?
That is a matter, it's interesting you ask as I sit here looking across the Potomac at the dome of the U.S. Capitol. It is not just a scientific issue. It's, in my view, a philosophical or even a political issue. My friends who are liberal in orientation will argue impassionately that we're endangering the planet and that we could have a significant greenhouse effect, enough to where the Earth's overall average temperature might rise 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees in the next century, which may sound trivial.
Oh, no.
But that amount of temperature increase would begin to melt the giant glaciers and ice flows up in Greenland, which in turn would raise the water table enough to where you would have flooding along the coastal regions of the United States.
Yes.
It would be very severe indeed. My conservative friends and colleagues claim that the industrialization is not that bad and that, in fact, volcanoes and other things pump out these materials all the time.
That we don't have the power, and it's egotistical to imagine we do, to affect the environment. Which school of thought, scientifically, forget the politics for a moment, do you accept?
Oh, I accept the former. I really think that the evidence is pretty compelling that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have been pumping out these greenhouse gases, and I think the automobiles and the factories are today. I'm not an alarmist. I'm not suggesting that we stop industrialization, for heaven's sakes.
I
don't want to turn us into a third world nation. But I do think we have to be cautious, and we have to really try to restrain in doing that.
All right. Man's invention time says I've got to pause. Stay right there. Dr. Richard Berenson, my guest. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 13th of June, 1996.
Top of the morning across the greater part of the world. My guest is Dr. Richard Berenson, and we'll get back to him in a moment. Now to Dr. Richard Berenson. Doctor, there was a report on ABC, as a matter of fact, day before yesterday, a very disturbing report. As you know, there's a drought going on in the Midwest, actually in our farm belt. And they say now scientists are suggesting that our farm belt may be in the process of turning into a desert. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't, but those kind of things have happened before, and they can happen again.
So apparently our climate, according to scientists, is far more fragile than we previously thought it was. In other words, small change, big effect.
Well, you know, this is one of the outcomes of chaos theory, and we are beginning to get more refined on being able to predict these kind of seemingly unpredictable phenomena. I don't think the listeners, though, in the Midwest should panic about this. I really think an alarmist sound here would be unwarranted. I think what it suggests is that meteorology and very careful study of this is warranted, and I hope the federal government will do that. What we have known in geological times in the past is that regions have changed dramatically. Where there have been no deserts, deserts have formed. We can find very compelling evidence that regions of the world today, where you would never think there would have ever been a desert, there used to be deserts.
Yes.
The world has changed dramatically. What we don't know is the time scale exactly in which it changes or how gentle a nudge can lead to this kind of change.
All right, quickly back to Mars. If there once was water on Mars, then is it unreasonable to presume there may have been a higher form of life long ago?
I would tend to doubt that there would be a higher form of life in the sense of higher than us or anything even remotely approaching us. What it would be possible would have been, in theory, that there might have been very elementary, primitive microbial life forms. If there was ever the conditions that it would have been warm enough, and by the way, it's pretty chilly there, and you would have had water, it would have been several billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But then the weather changed, and it would have frozen. And so then you could reasonably wonder what happened with the water and what about the outflow channels. We think that there were volcanic eruptions, perhaps, which heated things up, melted the water. That allowed these outflow channels, which we can now detect, and you can see where the water flowed, it then refroze. And Mars, as far as we can tell, has been in a permanently frozen state for a very long time. And we think that the water that used to be there is still there, but it's just down under the surface.
All right. Here's a pretty far-out question. Would it be possible, assuming that we could find a planet that would lend itself toward this possibility, to, in effect, take a sterile but workable planet, and mold it, terraform it, if you will, into something that would be friendly to human beings?
Oh, it absolutely is possible. The question is whether or not you want to do it and who's going to have the authority and right to do it. The United States does not own extraterrestrial objects. No nation does. And by international law and international agreement, no nation can. The U.S. was the first country to send human beings to the moon, and we planted our flag there, but it was done only symbolically. And then we left a plaque saying that we came in behalf of all humankind.
But wait a minute. You're saying this means we don't own the moon?
Certainly not. And the Soviet Union, by the way, had gone there before we had, something that most Americans have now forgotten. There was no Soviet cosmonaut aboard, but they did have a craft that got there before we did.
Probably planted a little flag.
They might have. Who knows? And, of course, they were the first to Venus, and we were the first to Mars. But we don't own any of those things. With respect to terraforming, I suspect a modified general form of that definitely will occur. I was asked by NASA headquarters a few years ago to come in and work on the space plans for the United States off into the 21st century, and I can tell you we have in the files detailed plans of how to build space colonies on Mars, on asteroids, on the moon and elsewhere, and how to use indigenous material. You know, the main cost is getting the material there, just the weight of lifting it and transporting it. And one of the things that you desperately need, of course, is water.
Yes.
We consume huge amounts of water, and water weighs 64 pounds per cubic foot. So that's an awful lot of weight to lift there.
Yes, it is.
On the other hand, if we can extract hydrogen and we can extract oxygen out of the lunar regolith, out of the lunar soil, we could combine the two and make our own water out of the lunar material. So that I think we will do, and I think we will build encased capsules which will produce our own atmosphere so that the astronauts can walk around without wearing spacesuits. That is a modified form of terraforming. In terms of rebuilding the whole place to somehow look like Earth, I don't know.
Wouldn't glass be, glass be a natural building material in such a place?
Yeah, it would. And by the way, one of the first places that you might use it would not be on the moon, nor on Mars, but on an asteroid. Something that most people don't realize would probably be easier for us to reach than the moon. Asteroids, of course, are these chunks left over from the formation of the solar system. Most of them are fairly small, but some of them are really quite large indeed. And you could imagine putting a little tug, a rocket tug, which would move it into Earth orbit, then going up and landing astronauts on it. By the way, the U.S. has a spacecraft called NEAR, Near Earth Asteroid Rendezvous, which was launched a few months ago. It'll be the first time in human history that we will send a spacecraft to fly close to an asteroid and begin to study them. And then early in the next century, we will send robots to land on them. So we're not talking about science fiction a century from now, but say 10 years from now.
All right. A wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Berenson. Hi, where are you, please?
I'm in Honolulu, Hawaii. My name's Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, doctor, you just hit just about on the question I was going to ask. Why don't we take, when we know some of these asteroids and these comets are coming by in our close, in our proximity, why don't we hitch a ride on these asteroids or comets with a beeping device or some type of sensor device that can send back data to the United States, to the world, to us here, on their travels?
Actually, that's a very good point, Jerry, and indeed we intend to do that. And one of the things which is on the drawing board to do early in the next century is to send a craft, think about this, it's really the stuff of romance, to fly alongside a comet. And a comet, as you know, is this iceberg which is in orbit around the sun. And as it approaches the sun, it begins to defrost and forms this long filamentary tail which can stretch tens of millions of miles. Well, we flew through Halley's Comet in 1986, or rather the Europeans did, but this would give us a chance actually to fly it along with it throughout its entire course. We have just not yet studied very well these near-Earth passing objects, and we really should, because it's a terrific opportunity, and they could be life-threatening as well as life-giving. Some of the organic material in your body came from comets that fell on Earth, and the next time you get a drink of water, ask yourself, where did the water come from? And you say, well, it came from the reservoir. Yeah, and where did it come from? Well, it came from the rain. And where did it come from? Well, it came from volcanoes that blew it out of the center of the Earth. But where did it come from? Well, we think that much of it, in fact, came from comets falling on Earth.
Like the comet that they just found, they didn't know where it came from, or comets that we know come by every 2,000 years or so. Why not hitch a ride on one of those, because they go so far out into the solar system and the data and stuff like that that it could retrieve while traveling and send back that data to Earth?
Well, that's an interesting idea. In other words, hitch a ride along on a long-period comet. I think one of our problems on that, though, Jerry, is just the orbital mechanics of achieving it. You have such a very short lead time. You don't know when those long-period comets are going to come. You have absolutely zero warning. You don't know that it's going to come 2 years and 3 days from now. The shorter period guys are all tabulated in books, and we really know their orbits really quite well. And in order for us to send a probe so that it could go into the right kind of trajectory and latch onto it or travel with it, we'd really have to plan that many, many months in advance. And, for example, the comet that came by just a few months ago, we had a lead time of all of about a month or so.
By the way, surprise of the detection of X-rays being emitted by a Hayutake?
Absolutely. I mean, nobody expected anything like that. And moreover, you know, this is a very bizarre comet. Its chemistry is now suggesting to us that either it's of a class of comets that we know virtually nothing about, or, even more interesting, it's maybe not a part of our solar system.
Ooh.
Maybe this is a comet that got captured by our solar system and was not originally a part of our own.
What about the comet yet to come? I think in about a year, less than a year, comet Hale-Bopp.
Actually, it's up there right now. It's difficult to see, but it can be seen. And I know you are quite a computer buff.
I am.
There is a homepage for Hale-Bopp, and also the Sky and Telescope magazine has a homepage, and you can obtain the coordinates for it. And so anyone who's listening who's an amateur astronomer and like to take a look, you can find it. It is about the seventh magnitude, which means that it is too difficult to be, you can't see it with your naked eye, but you can see it easily with a pair of binoculars. It is best seen, however, in about 6 or 8 months. It'll be a delight, I think, by January or February of next year. And the current estimates are that it's going to totally outshine Hayutake, which was pretty spectacular.
I'm not sure whether anybody's thought about this, but I would like to ask Dr. Berenson. Doctor, we've talked about black holes. Could there be such a thing, Doctor, as miniature black holes?
Well, that's certainly been an interesting hypothesis. It's one that Stephen Hawking in England has written about. It would require extraordinary conditions, and the only time we know of that those kind of extraordinary conditions to have caused such a thing would have been during the Big Bang itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hawking has done the computations, and others have too, which has suggested that given the exceptional blast of radiation that we think occurred then, in theory, there could be very miniature black holes, which would be tiny things, not the mass of a star, but much, much smaller. So far, none have been found, but they're fascinating to think about because they could be anywhere. They could be floating right through our own Earth.
Well, that's my next question. If we should run into even a miniature black hole, theoretically, what would happen?
Well, it would penetrate through essentially anything it wanted. By the way, right now while we're sitting here, you know, neutrinos are zapping through your body, many of them per square centimeter all the time. So those kind of cosmic intruders are out there. We have, however, not detected any evidence of a miniature black hole colliding with anything. So you would think that eventually you would find some kind of evidence of it.
Would it just cut a hole straight through the Earth?
Well, yeah, or it would cause some sort of an explosion as it sucked the matter into it. But in any case, you should see some kind of disruption. You should see some sort of gravitational perturbation. You should expect to see a planet wobble. You should expect to see something.
Yikes.
And maybe we haven't been looking long enough, or maybe the effects are too small for us to detect, but so far, no evidence.
Nothing to look forward to, though.
No, not really.
Yeah.
There are a lot of bizarre objects out there. You know, we were talking about black holes earlier. The notch before a black hole, of course, is a neutron star or a pulsar.
Oh, they're fascinating.
Unbelievable, extraordinary, and talking about what happens if you were to hit one. If you were to take a piece of a neutron star the size of your fist and suspend it over the Earth and break the suspension, then it would rush towards the center of the Earth. It would crash through your floor. It would rush through the granite underneath you. It would just keep plunging through the Earth because its density would be so much greater than that of the Earth. It would move with the same freedom that your hand moves through the air right in your room.
Wow.
It would go right through the center of the Earth, rush all the way to the far side of the Earth, say to China, turn around and bounce back because of the gravitational tug. It'd be like a big yo-yo going up and down.
That would be very bad. How fast does a neutron star spin? And as it spins, it generates, does it not, radio waves?
Yeah, and its rate of spin depends upon the object, its mass, and so on. But they spin exceedingly fast. They might be of the order of turning around its axis once a second, or maybe even 100 times a second. So you have to imagine an object which is initially 10 times perhaps the mass of the sun, now collapsing down to such a small, compact, rapidly rotating object that it can spin around 100 times a second. Quite amazing.
Aren't they kind of like radio beacons in space?
Well, our theory is that as it compresses down, it squeezes its magnetic field so that it spurts out, as it were, at both the north and south pole, and it's what we call the lighthouse effect. As this thing wobbles around in the same way that you see a lighthouse beam only when it sweeps by you and you don't see it all the rest of the time, you would see this pulsar only when its beam sweeps by you, and then a second later, by it goes again.
The East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Richard Berenson. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Where are you?
Wisconsin.
All right.
Art, you just basically asked my question here, but I was wondering how large this last Japanese comet was. And, well, they say what, Hale-Bopp is supposed to be the size of a large city, is it? Do you,
those are both good questions, yes. What about the size of these two?
Well, first of all, we have to define what we mean by the size of the comet. A comet has a nucleus, which is this frozen sort of dirty iceberg, and that's what you're referring to. And being typically the order of a few miles in diameter, it's about the size of a good-sized comet. Once the comet starts approaching the sun, though, it begins to defrost, and it forms a coma, and that coma becomes substantially larger, and then it forms the long filamentary tail, which, of course, is the most dramatic part. So far as we can tell, Hale-Bopp is intrinsically a bigger comet than Hayataki was, and given the amount of activity that it's already showing, This thing could be really quite dramatic, and it's not just a matter of seeing an impressive sight in the sky. Realize you're seeing an old ancestor coming back to visit us. It is the very stuff of which we ourselves are made. And more than half of the cells in our body, after all, is composed of water, and that water, in part, is a comet. So you're drinking a comet. We're made of this stuff, and comets back in the formative days of the Earth, 4.5 billion years ago, pounded into this planet. We're really quite convinced of that. And some of those comets brought with them organic molecules, and we ourselves are in part are made not only of the water, but probably even of the organic stuff itself.
Doctor, as a comet approaches our sun and this defrosting process begins, is there a possibility that a piece of it will break off? And if so, would that piece maintain roughly the same trajectory as the main comet, or could it assume a different trajectory?
Well, it gets a bit tricky. Comets have been known to break apart, in fact, as they swing around the sun. After all, you know, a comet's using itself up.
Yes.
Every time the comet goes around the sun, you know, it's using up some of its material, so it has a finite lifetime. Halley's Comet has been recorded back for many centuries, but it eventually will die because it'll just use itself up. As for breaking off, there have been a few cases of comets going around the sun being tidally disrupted, breaking apart, and ending up as two comets as they come around the other side. There have also been some comets that have actually collided with the sun. They've been going in an orbit which would swing them around, but then they get perturbed by something, by a planet or something, which moves them into a slightly peculiar orbit, and they never make it around. They crash into the sun, and they're gone.
So, I assume when they hit the sun, it would just gobble them up and not even think
twice about it. Oh, they're vaporized. I mean, you know, you got an ice ball going into a fire. Not a happy thought.
All right, my friend, we are out of time, and I'm sure you're probably very glad of that. You have really been a joy to have on the air, and I would like someday to bring you back again.
Well, I'll be happy to. I enjoy your program. You're a great host. You have great listeners. I'm a little tired at the moment, but let's try it another evening.
It's about 5 o'clock back there.
It is indeed.
Okay.
I just heard my newspaper hit out front.
All right, well, time to go pick it up. Doctor, thank you so very much.
All right.
Take care.
Good night.
Dr. Richard Berenson, and I just know you've enjoyed that. What a wonderful, wonderful 3 hours. Don't touch that dial, because we have another physicist, an atomic physicist, coming on next. He's Stanton Friedman, and he has some shocking news for you from Brazil. He's just back. That's coming up right after the top of the hour. A full scientific report on what are affectionately being called Art's parts, along with electron scanning microscope photographs and the spectrography charts, all up on my website right now. Be sure to take a look and comment for us. It is www.artbell.com on the World Wide Web. www.artbell.com. We'll pause here at the top of the hour, and a big piece of important information upcoming. Stay right there.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
And in just a moment, we will travel across 4 time zones from where I am to Fredericton, New Brunswick in Canada, and a nuclear physicist named Stanton Friedman. And he has got some really, really interesting information for you, and I'm going to let it unfold en naturel in a moment. So stand by for that. All all the way now to Fredericton, New Brunswick. Interesting place. Stan Friedman, welcome to the show. He says as he pushes the button, there you are. Stan, welcome to the program.
Glad to be on. Incidentally, you got to have to answer a question for me. When you say CBC Radio Network...
I know.
Hey, I'm up here where we have CBC.
I know. I frequently will say the American CBC.
Okay,
Radio.
I'll buy that. I'm an American and a Canadian, so I can work both sides of the border.
Why? You know, that's a good question. Why do you choose to live where you live, Stan?
Well, after all, I live near San Francisco. Doesn't everybody move from there to Fredericton, New Brunswick? It's easy, Art. My wife's from this part of the world. She's one of nine kids, and there are a lot of family back here. There was none in Northern California. And, yeah, people say, gee whiz, the winters are rough. Well, they're not too bad. We have two seasons here, winter and 2 months of poor splitting. And it's a great place to raise a family. And, you know, I really don't miss some of the California advantages like big earthquakes, drive-by shootings, drugs, smog. I don't need to tell you about living away from some of the advantages of big city life.
Yes.
And I travel all over the place anyway, and I'm near the American border. And I mention that because my post office box is in Maine, and people say, well, wait a minute, you said New Brunswick, you give out an address in Maine, what's going on here? Well, it's convenient and close, and Americans don't know postage is higher to Canada than,
sure,
than it is to the state. So it's a great place. I recommend it, not in the winter time, but University of New Brunswick and all that stuff.
For about 2 months a year, it's nice.
Actually, for about 5 months a year.
5 months a year. All right, look, there may be a lot of people who don't know who you are, Stan. You
really?
Are. Well, of course, yeah, it's always possible. You are a nuclear physicist. Give us a little bit about your background.
Bachelor's and master's degrees in physics from the University of Chicago. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years, even though we're on opposite sides of the UFO fence. Then I've had a sort of weird career, 14 years in industry, working only on eventually canceled, very advanced, highly classified nuclear and space system development programs, things like nuclear airplanes, fission and fusion rockets, nuclear power plants for space, little companies like General Electric, Westinghouse, General Motors, TRW Systems, Aerojet General. I was an itinerant physicist, as it turned out. I didn't intend to be, but that's what happened. I got interested in flying saucers in 1958, a long time ago, just by reading a book and then reading a bunch more books. And I'm a little slow. I gave my first lecture in 1967. I found I enjoyed it. The public liked it. Much more important to me, the professional groups to which I spoke, engineering societies, Los Alamos National Laboratory, sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, that sort of group, responded so well that when the bottom fell out of the nuclear and space system business in 1970, I went full-time as a speaker. I continued that until 1982, that I did a lot of nuclear consulting and stuff, and I kept up the lecturing, the writing, the investigating, even got, would you believe, research grants for UFO investigation, which were pretty rare back then.
Oh, yes.
And now I've spoken at more than 600 colleges, 100 professional groups, all 50 states, 9 provinces, 12 cities in England. Just got back from speaking in Brazil, Finland, Italy. I get around, and I've published more than 70 papers about flying saucers. I'm the original investigator on the Roswell incident dating back to the 70s. Co-author of the book Crash at Corona, because actually nothing crashed at Roswell. It crashed nearer to Corona.
Mm-hmm.
And got a new book coming out sometime within the next 3 months, it says. I don't know when.
What is it?
Top Secret / Magic, M-A-J-I-C, about the infamous Majestic 12 documents. I've been to 15 archives. I get around. Because I worked on classified programs, I know something about security. And it reviews the evidence, including some new documents never previously published about MJ-12, Majestic 12, and makes a strong case, I hope, only time will tell, I suppose, that some of the MJ-12 documents are legitimate and therefore the most important ones ever leaked to the American public because they state unequivocally that in 1947 a crash flying saucer was recovered with bodies and that a group was appointed, Majestic 12, accountable only to the President of the United States. And the question, of course, is whether the documents are genuine.
Yes.
And there are a lot of armchair theorists out there who think they don't need to go to an archive. They can write letters, and those documents are obviously fraud, they say. I think I make the case in the book that they're not obvious frauds and that some are genuine. And it's been an exciting time with regard to MJ-12 and Roswell and that crazy big fuss about the autopsy footage, supposed autopsy footage.
Yes.
And I have to say this, one of the highlights of the past year, besides finishing the book and a CD-ROM, UFOs, The Real Story, and frankly, as I'm incredulous as to how much information you can put on a CD-ROM, but I actually was involved in a debate at the historic Oxford University Debating Society last October, the very same place where O.J. Simpson appeared months later. The only thing is, I won.
What a podium to share, huh?
Yeah, it was kind of strange to watch him on television in front of that, because it's an old building, you know, and the audience is right on top of the speakers. I mean, there's no stage or anything, you know, you're just standing there. But you'll be pleased, or I don't know if you'll be pleased, somebody will be pleased to hear that the topic for debate and the students involved, the men wore tuxes and the women wore gowns, I was incredulous, was this house believes that intelligent alien life has visited planet Earth. And several of the students were speakers who knew absolutely nothing about the subject, but were very clever in their speaking. Oxford prepares politicians for a future life, you know.
Indeed.
And I was the anchor man. The man before me on my side was a solicitor who has worked with a lot of abductees.
You mean they didn't get Phil Klass over there?
No. The opposition was a writer, a very clever writer, who also seemed to be ignorant of the facts. I presented slides for 20 minutes. Anyway, what was important is the bottom line. Only members can vote. Anybody can go to the place, but only members can vote on the topic at hand after the debate. And it was 207 to 140. 60% said, yea, verily, Earth is being visited by intelligence.
Congratulations. You won.
Well, yeah, you know what surprised me? I did 40 interviews during that two-week period, radio, television, newspapers, whatever. There was a publicist going crazy arranging all these things all over England, and I found that 98% of the English journalists knew nothing about the subject. Many of my audiences, none of them had read any of the five large-scale scientific studies that I discussed. So even though there are some fine English ufologists, this was by and large a country which hasn't heard about the science side of things. So to get 60% under those circumstances of, man, a pretty good audience, Oxford University, was very pleasing to my partner and I. And
why do you think they're so generally uninformed on the subject there?
There is very much an attitude on the part of the what I call the ancient academics, the fossilized physicists of the country, the journalists,
mm-hmm.
that there's nothing to this subject, and very few scientists over there have spoken out at all. And so
they're afraid of
the tabloid side, and that's what they see.
They're afraid of it.
Yeah, fear of ridicule is a primary attribute, and you know, I wasn't surprised at the results. If you look at the Gallup polls for the last 30 years in this country, and forget about the people who say, I don't know what's going on, 60% of the rest say, indeed, that flying saucers are real, and the greater the education, the more likely to say so.
Mm-hmm, that is true. All right. Let's, for a second, talk about Roswell. Is it, in your view, the best documented case, the most likely to have been true?
Well, I hate to rank cases. Certainly there's been more attention given to it as sort of what somebody described to me as the holy grail of ufology.
That's right, yes.
You know, sort of a strange way of putting things. But there has, in comparison with any other case, there's probably been more attention paid, more witnesses found. a clear indication of government cover-up. And what people tend to forget, I mean, this is, 1996, I think. We're talking a long time ago, so of course a number of the major witnesses have died. You can't help that. But when I hear people attack some of the witnesses, just the UFO nut and things like that, I get angry. I was the first to talk to many of the key witnesses, and remembering that the 509th, the military group involved at Roswell Army Airfield at the time, was unique. It was the only atomic bombing group in the world. There were hand-picked officers, hand-picked men, high security. A key witness, for example, was at that time Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was at the 8th Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas. The 509th reported to the 8th Air Force.
Right.
8th Air Force was part of the Strategic Air Command. A nice clear chain here. Dubose was the chief of staff to General Roger Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force, under which was the 509th. Now, Dubose, not only a West Point grad, 18,000 hours as a pilot. He set up the Air Force's search and rescue team. I spent time with him at his home before he died. When he tells you that he got a call from the acting head of the Strategic Air Command, telling him on July 8th, 1947, to cover up this story, to send some of that wreckage up here when it gets there with one of your colonel couriers, and never to talk about it again, that's an order. Do I need to put it in writing? And Dubose says, no, sir. when a couple-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it, you know.
That's right.
I got that directly from him. That isn't made up, reconstructed, suggested by the evidence. He told me that face-to-face.
Well, there's more. There's Goldwater and LeMay. I've got that on tape.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are outstanding people involved, and even Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer for the 509th. Now, there have been four different television programs. They all portrayed the wrong notion of how his story came to light, making him sound like an angry old man who wanted to vindicate himself because he was treated badly in 47.
That's right.
That's hogwash. I got to him in the simplest way possible. I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, 1978, early in the year, the same day I was speaking at Louisiana State University, Flying Saucers Are Real. And the station manager is embarrassed because the third reporter to whom I was supposed to speak was late, not there, and the guy knew I had a busy day schedule. Out of the blue, we're having coffee, chit-chat, idle, and he's embarrassed looking at his watch, where the heck is the reporter? He finally says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Mm-hmm. A brilliant investigator that I am. I said, who's he? Oh, well, he handled pieces of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. Well, needless to say, that woke me up.
I'm sure it did.
What do you know about him? Well, he lives over in Houma, Louisiana. I didn't know where that was at the time. I was there later. And we're old ham radio buddies. Good guy. Well, the reporter showed up. I'm so glad that reporter was late. Next day, I called Major Marcel. I called information, got his number, talked to him. He hadn't talked to anybody about this in years. But he told me what he remembered. He didn't have a date, though. This is over 30 years later. I was at Bemidji State College in Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm sure they hear you up there.
Yes, they do.
And a couple comes up to me after a full house lecture and says, ever hear anything about a crash flying saucer in New Mexico? Well, yeah, I've heard stories. Tell me more. They tell me about a friend of theirs who worked for the government, mind you, the Soil Conservation Service, another outstanding individual, in Socorro, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he had told them about coming across a downed flying saucer with bodies next to it. I got that information, passed it on to Bill Moore, with whom I had worked very hard on the research that led to the first book, The Roswell Incident. First book about Roswell, 1980, mind you.
Right.
And Bill had a story from an English actor, actually a Canadian, but he lives in England. He's still alive. I talked to him a couple months ago. Huey Green. He, on the radio, heard stories about a crash flying saucer while heading toward Philadelphia from Los Angeles. When he got to Philadelphia, nothing. He could pin down the date. end of June, early July 1947, Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, started going through all the newspapers, and there was the story. And a lot of people think, because the article has been seen so many times on television, that the story only appeared in the Roswell Daily Record, hardly one of the world's great newspapers. Matter of fact, probably the best newspaper in Roswell today, because it's the only one, but anyway,
it appeared
in the Chicago Daily News.
Actually, it's a good newspaper. We're on the air in Roswell, too.
Okay, it is a good newspaper, and the people there have been most cooperative. But the article did appear in the Chicago Daily News headline, in the Spokane Chronicle, in the Sacramento Bee, probably in all those cities, too.
Sure.
In the Los Angeles Herald Express, full-width headline, Army Finds Flying Saucer. It was all over the place in evening papers. And I stress the evening because of the timing of the press release. July 8th, 1947. The cover story went out 5 hours later from Fort Worth, Texas, from General Ramey. Next day's papers said, Ramey empties Roswell saucer. And that was the end until I got involved more than 30 years later. So, Major Marcel never sought attention. He talked to people who contacted him. I gave his name and number to several media people, did some television interviews, all that sort of thing. But he did not seek attention. And a noisy negativist in England said, Major Marcel sold his story to the National Enquirer, which is hogwash. There was an article in the Enquirer, 1980, after Bill Moore and I had talked to over 60 people. The Air Force, the villain in the piece, if you will, which has been playing hardball about Roswell the last couple of years after totally ignoring it for 40-some years, tells us that the story came to light when a tabloid, the National Enquirer, carried an article saying that Major Marcel was claiming that he recovered wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. Also in 1978, a UFO researcher, Stanton Friedman, they can't say nuclear physicist, you see. Mm. That would spoil the story.
Yes.
Began looking for other witnesses after meeting with Major Marcel. Well, the Enquirer article was 2 years after the story began. We'd already talked to 60 witnesses. I don't get my research ideas from tabloids. But, you see, that tabloidizes the story, and therefore we can ignore it.
That's right. But in your best estimation, the evidence leans heavily toward the fact that it did occur.
Well, more than heavily. When you look at all the testimony, and it's, people are attacking now the Air Force, would you believe that one of the Air Force guys who wrote that was involved in that, it's $52 if you want the report, incidentally. GPO has to make a buck or two.
Sure.
It's about 1,000 pages. It's the Roswell Report, Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. Unfortunately, the Air Force provides the fiction.
All right. On that note, hold tight for a minute, Stan. We'll be right back to you, and I have Roswell-related questions, as you might well imagine, coming up next.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 13, 1996.
Over the years, Stan, there have been a number of things that have been said to be Roswell artifacts, pieces of the crash craft and so forth. One piece in particular was given to the Roswell Museum, and so we have that to talk about. And then what do you make of that, if I can get your assessment first? What do you know and what do you make of it?
Well, okay, the story is Party A gives it to who was supposedly there at the recovery site, gives it to Party B, who is very fearful that he'll be killed if he says who he is, who gives it to Party C, who goes to the museum in Roswell. The thing was in a frame, literally a picture frame. It's several inches long.
Right.
And it's doesn't seem to be corroded. And what we know so far is it's made out of copper and silver, two common dense elements. It's used for decorative purposes, used for all kinds of things. Copper's all over the place, as you know. I don't know what to make of it. I see no reason so far without a provenance, you know, who was the first guy, and was he really at Roswell?
Sure.
Obviously, he's not seeking attention. It's in my gray basket, maybe. Now, I better stress that there is one story about a piece of a crash saucer, which leads me to believe that there are pieces out there. One of the reasons I've approached these with kind of an open mind. There was a pilot at Roswell Army Airfield called Pappy Henderson. He was a World War II pilot, you know, more than 50 missions in Europe and all that stuff. And he was in charge of ferrying supplies to the nuclear weapons test conducted on Operation Crossroads, 1946. 509 was involved in that. So he obviously was highly regarded. He even had to fly the VIPs who were out there for the test. There was a bomb let go underwater and one above the water out there. Nobody killed in these tests. And so Pappy, in the early 80s, saw an article in a newspaper about a crashed saucer at Roswell. This is because the first book, The Roswell Incident, was already out at a supermarket. And he tells his wife, Sappho, that, you know, he'd always wanted to tell her, but this was classified. But since there's an article in the newspaper, obviously some of it's been declassified, he flew some of that wreckage to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Right.
He also mentioned having seen bodies. Now, his story was known by Len Stringfield, who's dead now, but this was one of 50 stories Len had about crashed saucers. And I managed to locate Pappy's wife. Len wouldn't give me the address to protect her identity. And she told me what he had told her, and she was on the Unsolved Mysteries program in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
After the program, which was only seen by 28 million people, she found out that another old buddy of Pappy's, I mean, I'd already gotten the names of several of his people, and one of them had confirmed his World War II bombardier that Pappy had told him the story. But after the program was on, another one, a dentist, mind you, came forward, a mutual friend, and he told Sappho, and I talked to him. Not only had Pappy told him the story in 1978 on his honor as a former Navy officer, not to talk about it, which he didn't, but in 1979, he'd actually handed him a piece of the material, which unfortunately he took back and we haven't been able to find. But when you have a dentist telling you about this and what the material felt like and stuff, if Pappy had a piece, remembering the GI attitudes of World War II, if it moves, grab it.
Yeah, sure.
then other people must have had pieces as well, especially from the Corona site where there was debris all over the place.
All right. So it is reasonable to assume that people could have slipped them into pockets. People could have
in their shoe,
souvenirs, small pieces. Now,
yeah.
Several months ago, Stan, as you well know, I was sent what was alleged to be pieces from the crash in New Mexico, wherever it occurred, or one of them, however we look at this. Now, these pieces have been subjected to some fairly rigorous scientific investigation we have on my website now, a pretty good presentation with the electron microscope photographs and the scientific report, and there are anomalies with regard to the aluminum, not as much as we originally thought, but still remaining anomalies. Even more interesting, though, Stan, we've got this piece that purports to be from the skin. Now, when you get something like this, you assume I've either got, as they said in New Mexico, trash or treasure. Who knows?
Right.
And I thought, well, this stuff could be from a junkyard. But lo and behold, the scientific testing has shown that we have an incredibly strangely layered piece that purports to be from the skin of the spacecraft, layered with bismuth. I don't know what the hell bismuth is, and bismuth and magnesium. And this is clearly, you're a physicist, you tell me, this isn't something that come out of a junkyard, is it?
No. And it's interesting because these are sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum. Magnesium is lightweight, lower density than aluminum. And it's used in all kinds of applications. The first space satellite, Sputnik, was made out of magnesium because it's very lightweight. Bismuth, on the other hand, is up there with lead. It's much more expensive than lead, and it's got some peculiar properties, electronic properties and other things. But the thought of putting the two together in a layered structure is quite remarkable, as a matter of fact. And now, one note of caution here. Many people think that, well, gee, you just take this stuff to the lab, whatever this crazy wreckage is, you find out it's made of elements not from here, and ipso facto, you've got an extraterrestrial remnant. But that isn't the way it works. One expects, from all our studies of the stars out there, all over the galactic neighborhood, that the same elements are out there as are here, but they may be manufactured for a different purpose and with a different technique and have unusual properties, not always easy to discern. I mean, suppose somebody had found a chip from a computer.
Semiconductor,
50 years ago. We couldn't even have analyzed it well enough to find out all the stuff that's in there, and we certainly couldn't have duplicated it.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of digging to come up with something, and also there's a complication. I worked on classified nuclear programs. We often used exotic materials, things like lithium hydride, boron carbide, beryllium oxide, tungsten, rhenium, I mean, weird stuff. Now, it may well be that there are special alloys created, special structures, for various military programs that the average good scientist in the lab knows nothing about. And so you have to be very careful before you say, this is odd, therefore extraterrestrial. You got to get somebody who can say, well, no, we didn't use that in our latest laser weapons device.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. So it's a long, difficult process.
Yes, it is, and it's been underway for a while. I spoke with Linda Howe earlier today, and she has been looking very carefully into the bismuth industry, such as it is, and has yet found no application. And she's talked to some fairly, heavyweights in the area, has found nobody who has said there is application, or we ever know of anybody who has put or layered this bismuth magnesium in this way. And so, how would you classify this in terms of interest level, say, compared to what they've found down or has been turned over to the museum in Roswell?
Well, this stuff is no doubt, this as opposed to the aluminum pieces, which is another matter entirely, this stuff is undoubtedly curiouser and curiouser. It's weird. It's strange. It's different. That doesn't yet make it extraterrestrial, but certainly puts it at center stage to say, what in the world is this? In other words, nobody running to the junkyard could come up with this, as far as I know.
All right, what application can you imagine if you were to conjecture a bismuth magnesium layered substance, and there are many, many layers. Have you seen the electron scanning photograph? Oh, it's amazing, Stan.
Somebody said 15 layers?
Yeah, something like that. 15 layers at the micron level.
And that's weird. That's not easy to do, incidentally.
Right.
I will tell anybody who says, oh, I can make that. Yeah, go ahead. Show me.
All right.
There are several possibilities here. If it really was from skin, and if this device used not jet engines, obviously, or internal combustion engines, if there was, say, an electromagnetic or magneto-aerodynamic system, and I've been talking about such systems since the late 60s in my congressional testimony, because there is work that points in that direction. If there were, then it may have very peculiar electrical and magnetic properties.
Hmm.
That's one major possibility. There's a lot of work showing if you can create electric and magnetic fields at the right orientation to each other, you can control heating, drag, lift, radar profile, a whole bunch of other things by running a current through the outer boundary of whatever you got going up there. So that's one possibility. Another is that it may fulfill one of the objectives that you need. For example, heat protection. It could be, I don't know of any superconductor made out of just those two metals, but there are special superconducting materials which allow for the passage of a very high current, the creation of a big magnetic field, etc., that are made out of bismuth compounds. But that these aren't compounds as far as we can tell.
Where is bismuth in the elemental table, do you know?
It's way up there, like I say, close to lead on the chart.
Huh.
And normally found, it's similar to lead in a lot of its properties. For example, here in New Brunswick, Canada, we mine a lot of lead and zinc, and they recover bismuth at the same time. It's present much lower abundances, but it's a byproduct of the production of these other materials. Compounds, this may sound a little strange, but because lead and bismuth together, they make compounds which have low melting points. They can be used as a heat transfer agent, believe it or not.
Huh.
And they're dense, so they're good gamma ray shielding material. And in a reactor, people have actually run heat transfer systems with lead and bismuth. Now, it's heavy, not quite as heavy as mercury, for example. So it's a high atomic number element that most of us won't see. There are some organic chemical compounds with some medical properties and stuff that have bismuth in them, but not in layers with magnesium, believe me.
Yes, the other interesting thing about it, of course, is it's very charred on the outside, very charred, as though well, I don't know, just charred, and I'll let
heated.
Heated, yes, heated, there you go. And then there's the aluminum pieces. Interesting, they say the spike is just tremendous purity, but the interesting thing about the aluminum is the sand. In the electron scanning photographs, this aluminum hit something very hard, Stan. It's got sand embedded in it. The pictures are very graphic. So,
yeah, I saw that discussion. Fascinating on that end of things.
So, yeah, so the whole thing is stranger and stranger, and the deeper we dig, I take it you talked to Linda earlier in the day. She's beginning
yes.
to get, in a sort of quiet way, pretty excited.
Well, yeah, and one thing I should stress here, and a lot of people may not realize, Linda doesn't have a real budget for analysis.
That's right.
A couple of years ago, a colleague and I thought we would have access to some pieces of material, okay? I've been down this road. So we lined up a lab, an outstanding testing lab in Southern California, which does forensic testing. In other words, for example, if an airplane crashes, was it a failure of something, in which case millions of dollars could ride on the analysis of that? Was it failure of an electronic component? Again, you've got to really do first-class forensic testing that can stand up in a court of law with the other lawyers hitting at you, so you really got to know your stuff. We lined up such a lab. We were hoping to get access to a piece of material, very lightweight, supposedly bendable material that you couldn't scratch with a knife and stuff, about a few inches square, okay? We felt that in order to get that analysis done properly, obviously, depending on what happens the first time, the second time, what tests you run without destroying the material, good idea, you know, that it would probably cost about $20,000.
Right.
To do that testing. So people have complained there was the anomaly or supposed anomaly about the density, the specific gravity, and so forth.
Sure.
Hey, the guy was doing the work for nothing.
That's right. And I don't know whether you know who the guy is. We don't say, of course,
no.
who it is. But
he's a biologist, isn't he?
And he's a very well thought of and qualified. I don't want to say any more than that.
Yeah.
But
he's
error.
He's donating his time.
That's right.
And his expertise. And if somebody out there would like to donate a big chunk of money, we certainly know where we can get a whole battery of tests done first rate, where people will sign their names and stand up in court and all that sort of thing.
Sure.
But this work does not come cheap.
So at the end of the investigation, and I'll tell you, Stan, I turned it over to Linda. It's not such a blessing getting materials like this. At first you think, wow, this is really cool, this is great. You quickly realize from several points of view that it's not such a blessing as you might imagine it is, and the world begins to come toward you with all kinds of criticisms and
boy, I'll say.
You know, so It's been a little rough going, but I'm committed to keep going, and I'm glad we did, or else we never would have come to the point we are at now, which is a fascinating point. And I suppose at the end of this, if the anomalies remain unanswered, then you go out and you look for funding and you get the kind of work done that you just talked about.
Well, there is something else, but I hope the guy who sent this stuff in is listening. You know, when I first read the first letter you got, my thought was science fiction, and it sounds science fiction-y. I hate to say that, but it's true. If we could work more on the other end, that is the provenance, if we could find out who his grandfather was and establish that that person was indeed at Roswell, I've got a copy of the base yearbook, and there's a lot of checking you can do on people. I've located lots of people and records on them and stuff. That would give us, even without going public with that, getting a certified, notarized statement from somebody that they have checked the records and so forth, that the party of the first part was indeed at Roswell and that sort of thing. That would give us a real leg up, because not knowing who got it or how he got it, there's a story there, but we don't know who the person was. That would make life a great deal simpler. And
sure,
for example, suppose he had picked up pieces of strange material at some other site entirely where they were testing the latest in rocket systems or Lord knows what. That would be very different from being involved with Roswell.
All right.
I will say this. If he actually heard about this, your source, back in the early 70s, which is how the story goes, that was before I first talked to Marcel in 78, even Lydia Sleppy's story about the military or the FBI shutting down transmission of a story from Roswell to Albuquerque on this, that I heard in the early 70s, that would make life a great deal easier and might make it simpler to get somebody to come forth with the money to do the job properly.
All right.
So, source, if you're out there, give Art a hand here, please.
Yes, we're up against a real wall here, and we've got interesting, anomalous stuff, and you could help us with the source. Now, we know you've got a military career, and I'm not sure what to say about that, Stan.
Can we guarantee that source that his name will not be made public or his grandfather's?
Of course. Yes, we can do that. I can do that.
Okay, because one thing that scares people...
Of course,
they may be reluctant to come forward if they think, oh, Christ, I'm going to have every ufologist in the world beating the past of my door.
Well, worse than that, he could lose a military career.
Yeah, minor detail, no pension, all that sort of thing, no
that's
job.
That's right. So, yes, we will make that guarantee. We certainly will. And I guess we'll finish up this hour now. We've got a fascinating thing coming up next hour on Brazil, folks, so don't go away. But we'll finish up this hour. Stan, do you know of anybody right now who has artifacts that are being tested that look as promising or interesting as what we have now?
Not that I know of. Absence of evidence is not evidence for absence, but I don't know of any, and the Roswell Museum people normally tell me about such things. So, no, the answer is no.
So we've got the most interesting lead at the moment.
Right.
All right, Stan, stay where you are. We'll be right back to you. My guest is Stanton Friedman, a nuclear physicist in New Brunswick. And by the way, if you want to see the report on those materials, my webpage is www.artbell.com. Take a look. It's fascinating. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 13th of June, 1996.
I'm Art Bell, and my guest is nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. He'll be back in a moment. The Roswell crash was 1947. That was then. This is now.
I began to hear rumors about it on the internet not long ago. Something about a crash in Brazil. Now, when I first saw them, I dismissed them pending further information. Guess who just came back from Brazil? Stan Friedman. That's right. And he knows a lot about what may have just happened in Brazil. Coming up next. All right, back now to Fredericton, New Brunswick in Canada, and Stanton Friedman. Stanton, when you get some things over the internet, you go, yeah, right. And with a lot of things that flow over the internet, you should go, yeah, right. But these stories began to come to me, I don't know, it was a couple of weeks ago, a week ago, about something that may have happened down in Brazil. And I sort of put them aside. Something may have come down, something to this world from elsewhere in Brazil. And I thought, yeah, right. But you were in Brazil, weren't you?
Yes, I was down there. Now, I should stress, because I had several phone calls of people who thought I heard this story and hopped on a plane. Sorry, no budget for that, guys.
So you were just lucky.
Well, yeah, the timing was lucky. I'd been planning. I'd been invited to this conference in Curitiba, Brazil, which is a couple hundred miles from Sao Paulo, many months ago. And I'd agreed to go down and to give a talk, you know, crash flying saucers, all that jazz.
Sure.
I speaking in English and being translated and then speaking in English, boy, that's tough, frankly.
Yes.
The holding on to your attention while they translate, never sure whether the audience is hearing what you said or thought or whether the interpreter has done a little interpretation there. But anyway, before I went down, the man in charge of the conference had notified me that there was quite a fuss about this Varginha case. About the capture of a couple of alien bodies with nets of alien beings and them being sent off to the States. And frankly, I had a very highly raised eyebrow, you know.
Sure.
Because it sounded weird. But he told me, he promised me that at the conference there would be people that I could talk to who spoke English.
Okay.
That would give me the inside story. Now, it turns out that in the interval from when I was invited to when this conference took place, and I just got back on Tuesday, that there has been even more investigation and more coverage in the Brazilian press. A major magazine, sort of the equivalent of Time or Newsweek or Weekly, U.S. News and World Report, that sort of thing, carried a story on May 22nd, six pages, a cover story with pictures. And they interviewed a number of the witnesses and so forth. And I was fortunate enough, while I was down there, to be able, with two other well-known researchers, John Carpenter, who's a psychiatric social worker from Springfield, Missouri.
I know him.
Who is in charge of abductions research for the Mutual UFO Network, has worked with 150 abductees, and I've known John for a number of years. And Graham Birdsall, who publishes UFO magazine in England, which has a worldwide circulation of about 50,000, which for a UFO magazine is quite something special. They were both there, and we were able to meet with a man, one of a team of people who gave to our paper there. This man has money enough, and I bring that up because it's hard to do the research without money.
We know.
He owns three coffee plantations, okay?
John Mack was also down there, wasn't he?
Well, that's what I was going to add. Right. And we found out that John Mack had been down there, met with some of the witnesses.
Wow.
We interviewed this researcher and got the whole story on videotape. John Carpenter has a tape of that. He speaks great English, so there's no problem that way. We are having a lot of stuff translated. And the story, as we got rid of the cultural problems, I mean, for example, one thing that bugged me, what do you mean the fire department came out with nets and captured this thing? That doesn't make any sense to me. Well, it turns out that in Brazil, if there is a mad dog or a monkey from the jungle or whatever, a strange animal that comes into a city, it's the fire department that goes out with nets, sort of like our dog catcher, you know, to capture these. Now, the man that we talked to has talked to military people. He has talked to medical people. He's well-connected, as it happens, right in the area where this happened. And so as the story evolved, it seems that several bodies were recovered of, I'll call them creatures because I don't know what other term to use, frankly. I don't want to say ETs, but it certainly doesn't sound like anybody from around here. Little guys, short, big heads, skinny bodies, oily skin.
Oily skin.
It looked as if somebody had brushed oil on them. Brown skin. Big, real big, red eyes.
Red eyes.
No genitals, apparently, from what we heard. No clothes. And the beings, I'll use the word dazed, obviously not in great shape, obviously not able to leap with great bounds and escape the people who were around. Whether they were having trouble because they hadn't eaten or were injured, or we just don't know.
Some sort of state of shock.
Yeah, seemingly, and more than one creature. And the initial report involved three young ladies, two sisters, ages, 14 and 16, I think. 22. Yeah, the two girls were 14 and 16. They had a friend with them who was 22.
All right.
And they were walking home, go past an empty lot. They look over, and one of the girls at first thought it was a statue. Here's a creature bent down, seemingly in distress, not moving or anything, and they screamed. I mean, you know,
I would too.
There were three bumps on the head as well, incidentally.
Uh-huh.
And relatively large feet, and crouched down, and the girls scream, and one of them thought it might be the devil, because it sounds a little, you know, red eyes, bumps on the head, the whole business.
I understand.
They go screaming on home, and their mother, their people in the neighborhood hear them, and there's some other people who see the being. And the mother calls the fire department, and they come on out and eventually capture the being. And we have other stories, a story in the morning, a story in the afternoon, and stories about a saucer sighting in the neighborhood, if you will. I say saucer. It's the shape of a submarine. We might call it cigar shape, who knows.
Right.
Not very large, moving maybe less than 15 feet over a farmer's field, disturbing his animals. That's what wakes him up. He and his wife see this thing chugging along, and there was white smoke, honestly, across their field, and their animals are going sort of crazy. Now, the story gets much more complicated in terms of there was a guy who apparently may have hit an alien on the road. The military come in. They pick up a creature, put him in a box. There are two different hospitals mentioned here.
Is this a Brazilian military?
Yes. Well, I should add that there's a connection in Brazil between the military, the fire department, the police departments. There are a couple of named military installations in the area, and the man we talked to has talked to some of those people, and he's been threatened, incidentally. And apparently an attempt was made to bribe the young girls by guys in suits, and it's an area where you don't expect to find guys in suits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a funny way to describe somebody, but, you know, this is not downtown Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so the story has swirled on. There is an indication of contact between the U.S. government and the Brazilian government about something expected to be coming down.
Hmm.
Now, I better add something here that people may not have thought about, but I'm sure they're aware of. Namely, that all governments, especially the Americans and the Russians, anybody who puts satellites up, would love to get their hands on the other guy's technology. If a spy satellite were to come crashing down.
No doubt about it.
I mean, that's valuable stuff. And, I better add, that we have military satellites in space in polar orbits that cross over the entire Earth over a period of time. And at those satellites, you know, these are with the cameras that you can read the license plate in the Kremlin parking lot, that sort of thing.
The KH series.
Yeah. These guys are looking for reentries. you know, if it's somebody else's missile, you certainly want to know that.
But, that's right.
So you could have an alert system, and we undoubtedly have a reward system. Anybody around the planet, hey, if something comes down, ours, theirs, anybody. Remember, you got to recover your own, too, because you don't want the other guy to recover it.
I'm sure we have such a thing, of course. And so we've got it with Brazil, I would imagine.
It's a big country.
Sure. If something comes down in Brazil, the following offer stands.
Yeah. Yeah, and Brazil is a place where offers matter, I was told. I won't say bribery and corruption were an everyday part of life, but I've been assured that perhaps they are in places. And, you know, it's with good, this isn't necessarily all bad. You know what I'm saying?
That yeah, of course.
If a piece of hardware comes down, you want to recover it.
It's national security.
Yeah, that's the big game in town. And so the story is evolving. I went down there quite skeptical. I found out that, while one should always be skeptical, that John Mack was apparently very impressed after his interview with the girls, and he spent several hours with the three of them, that they're not lying. There's a consistency from the man we spoke to about what the military say, the medical people say,
mm-hmm.
whole bunch of doctors. One of these bodies, at least, is dead. Another one was still alive at the time and was apparently shipped off to the United States.
What about the craft?
Well, the only, aside from this visual observation of this strange submarine-shaped thing quietly moving around the guy's field, there are other reports of trucks filled with strange, shiny wreckage.
Really?
So I am very hesitant. I got asked down there, well, okay, what do you think this competes with Roswell? And I have to say, not yet, because we don't have the direct connection between these strange bodies and a craft and people who see the two together. In other words, we need more linkage here.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean there isn't such a connection. But this is in its early stages. The people who were involved are still alive. You know, this is January we're talking about.
Sure.
And there, apparently the cover-up effort has not been fully successful. And so I'm very optimistic that there will be more information. The press attitude has been good. And I stress that because if the press attitude is ha, ha, ha,
well, press
people
attitude,
don't come forward.
Do you mean the press attitude in Brazil?
Yes.
Because other than the little internet leakage there has been, there certainly has been nothing significant
right.
in the American press yet.
That's right. And what I'm saying is for the locals, people who might know something, somebody who knows somebody who was at the hospital, that sort of thing, or who was in the military, the press attitude has been straight, which is all one ever wants. In other words, this is a story like a murder story or a plane crash story or something like that. Witnesses have been spoken to. Here's what they say. There is a consistent testimony from a lot of different people independently. And it's been played like a straight news story.
So the mainstream press there is playing it straight. Now, if that story were to now be covered here, what kind of play do you think it would get here, or what?
Well, I'm afraid of what it would turn out to be like. There'd be a brief story that doesn't explain things that would immediately be jumped on by the powerful American press. I'm thinking of how they've treated the Air Force and the GAO with regard to the Roswell story over the last couple of years, where the Washington Post and the New York Times, two outstanding newspapers, have gotten all the data wrong, basically because they presumed there was nothing to it and they
mm-hmm.
could just soak up the Air Force comment. So what I'm hoping will happen is that a major effort will be mounted to go down there. I'm ready to go back. Incidentally, about press, we had this UFO conference down there, you know?
Right.
Front page story on the local paper. Curitiba is a city of well over a million now. We're not talking a village.
Big city, yeah.
Yeah, and not far from Sao Paulo and so forth. And you see, my picture was on the front page with a CD-ROM I'm holding up about UFOs. John Carpenter was pictured on the front page on a different day. And we asked people to translate, of course, and it was not silly season hits Curitiba. It was taken very seriously. And so I'm optimistic that more information will come forward. A book is probably in there for somebody down there, because there were so many different strands of what was going on and where it was going on. And incidentally, Art, I'd like to make an offer. I've got a two-page report from an English language, actually by an American who lives down there, on the Vargina case. This just came out a couple weeks ago. And I'd be happy to send a copy. If people will send me a self-addressed stamp, number 10 envelope, and you can imagine if I had a write all the envelopes and put all the postage on, it's an enormous chore. A copy of this two-page article about Vargina. I'll have a list of my books and papers and about the CD-ROM and all that stuff, too.
Miller, but what's known about the incident down there? You've got a two-page report, and you're willing to give it to him?
Yeah, yeah, and just a self-addressed stamped envelope. Send it to Stan Friedman or UFO, Post Office Box 958. Houlton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N,
okay.
Maine, which is M-E, folks, not M-A,
right.
04730-0958. And I know from past experience that there are a lot of people who are going to send the envelope. That's why I say self-addressed, stamped, please.
Sure.
But it's the latest on Vargina that's available anyway. It's in English. And it may open a few eyes, and this is a story that's ongoing.
All right, let me help you out here, because I know Stan from experience. It's the middle of the night in a lot of the nation, and people are racing for a pencil or a pen. So let me repeat it. Send it to Stan Friedman, and that's F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N.
Right.
And I assume, Stan, that your post office is like mine, and if it just comes UFO, it gets to Stan Friedman.
Well, yeah, but it's nice to put in the post office box number.
All right, and you really give them a two-page report free of charge, eh?
Free of charge, no question. And we want to spread factual information. And incidentally, this stuff is not on my computer, so I can't email it to anybody. I'm a neophyte at that stuff, and I don't have a scanner and all that. So, you know, I realize I get people emailing me, in effect, saying, hey, send me all you have about, or email me all you have about the physics of flying saucers.
I know I get this sort of thing, too, and there's simply no way. Even if you had the computer, you couldn't handle that volume of requests or even that volume. So
that's right, and I've written a 20-page paper on the physics of flying saucers, you know, and the Cosmic Watergate and Roswell and MJ-12 and all this stuff, and there's just no way I can do that. So I'll send them a list, they can get what they want, but they'll get the free two-pager.
All right, well, that's good, because it certainly is not widely known. All right, Stan, hold on. We'll be right back to you, and we will go to the phones.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
My guest is Stan Friedman. He's a nuclear physicist in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. And he'll be back in a moment. If you have questions, we'd love to have you come forth now. All right, the stretch run, Stan.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for being with me. It's what time is it back there now?
It's about 7:38.
7:38 in the morning. Four time zones, huh?
Yep.
You must live right out at the edge there, where the fourth time zone.
It starts at the border between Maine and New Brunswick, and I often talk to people in the States, tell them how many hours you can't be. I said, hey, there's a time zone, the Atlantic time zone. What do you want from me? It changes when you cross the border.
Yeah, well, there you are. All right, here we go. On the first time caller line, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hi.
Yeah, hi. My name is Olaf from Los Angeles. And I had a statement regarding, you were talking about Pappy earlier. I guess that was, there was a show that was actually done on that called Baba Black Sheep, and Pappy was actually...
No. That's Pappy. Different Pappy.
Oh, different Pappy. Okay, my mistake.
Yeah, I know who you're talking
okay.
about. Buying Boyington, I believe.
Right, okay. Sorry, different Pappy. And the second thing I wanted to say was basically that I've heard that in conjunction with work in the U.S. government, this is just a rumor, of course, nothing to be proven, that the Greys were working with the U.S. government. Do you know anything to that effect, or have you heard things to that effect?
Such rumors have been swirling around for more than a decade. Right there in Las Vegas or Dulce or other places, Area 51, Groom Lake, you name it.
Yes.
I've heard these stories. I've heard the claims. At best, it's in my gray basket. I won't discount them. I won't say it can't be, it isn't, et cetera. But I have yet to see any convincing evidence that it is, and I recognize people are going to say, well, how about Bob Lazar? And I hate to say it. I've done a lot of checking on Mr. Lazar. He is not a scientist, no degrees from anywhere. He didn't go to MIT or Caltech. He was not a scientist for Los Alamos. It's kind of a sad tale. And his UFO propulsion scheme won't work either. And I bring this up because I was on a Larry King show out of the desert there.
Oh, I remember that. It's a desk out in the middle of the desert. And
yeah, really crazy setting. I mean, I've never done such an exotic circumstance.
Was it getting cold out there, Stan?
Yeah. It was. It started at 5 p.m. local time. That was October 1st, 1994. However, it was rerun again for the second time just a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people weren't aware that, you know, the show is 2 years old. And so I got asked about Lazar there, and after worrying about being sued, I did say he was a liar. And I, you know, if people want to know more about that, I can provide them information. But that's the only direct link. And often people want to shoot the messengers. I found a number of other frauds in ufology, and I got to go where the facts go. That's what we scientists do.
All right. The alien autopsy. What's your take on it now? We're down line a little bit now, and everybody's had a chance to have a good look.
Yeah, I've made five trips to England this past year or so, and I've met twice with Mr. Santilli, the exploiter of the film. Every time I've checked on what he has had to say, it turns out not to be true, which is sad. And again, I start from the position that, yes, bodies were recovered. Undoubtedly, autopsies would have been done, and undoubtedly, they would have been filmed. So I have no prejudice against the basic notion. However, I can find nothing in the footage, and Fox brought me down to Washington. I spent a couple of days going over this darn thing. And I've been to England, as I say, and I can't find anything in it that leads me to believe it has anything to do with Roswell, crash flying saucers, alien bodies. Mr. Santilli has just not proven to be trustworthy. Just one example of that. He quietly told me that the name of the photographer was Jack Barnett.
I've heard that name.
Yeah, and this is the guy who supposedly, I mean, the reason he got involved in the first place is he was looking for old Elvis Presley footage.
That's correct.
And Barnett had shot some of the early footage in Cleveland, Ohio in the mid-50s. And after he had bought the rights to this footage from Mr. Barnett, Barnett told him that he had some other stuff that he might be interested in. He could use the money for a wedding gift for his granddaughter. Now, when you start checking back, you find that indeed, according to the book Elvis A to Z, on page 221, there is a story about the first time Elvis was filmed. And it was by Jack Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great. Now, actually, though, the filming was done for a man named Bill Randall, who at that time was the first disc jockey outside the South to play Elvis stuff. He worked out of both New York and Cleveland, frenetic life. He's now a lawyer, incidentally, $300 an hour, and didn't like wasting his time on the phone with people like me who aren't going to pay him. But here's the kicker. Jack Barnett was indeed a well-known motion picture photographer, a cinematographer, was an officer in the Union. However, two big kickers. He was never in the military. He was a war correspondent, but not in the military. And he died in 1967, and I managed to get a copy of his death certificate. And so Mr. Santilli certainly never bought anything from Mr. Barnett in the 90s. And then he gave the name, well, that was a cover name. It was Jack Barrett. And he was in the military but got out in 45 and was not a motion picture cameraman. The next name was Jack Bennett, and I'm waiting for Garrett Gannett, etc. I was told in our first conversation within a week of when this big noise started in England that you could clearly see Harry Truman in the film.
That's right.
And I said, oh, and he also said that they had proven that Truman was in Dallas at the time of the autopsy. And, of course, now he's changed the location of the autopsy as well. And I said, oh, you checked with the Truman Library? Yes. Well, I've spent many hours, many days at the Truman Library, and I checked. They have no record of Truman being in Texas or New Mexico from June through October. When I told Mr. Santilli this in person, he said, oh, well, it was in conjunction with his trip to Ottawa. Now, his geography isn't very good. Ottawa is 450 miles directly north of Washington. Dallas is 1,100 miles southwest. And the trip to Ottawa, which did take place in mid-June 1947, was by train. And it was a visible trip. I mean, he spoke to Canadian Parliament, talked to people in Buffalo, you know.
All right, so the bottom line is you see a lot of holes.
Oh, yes. And the careful commentary, the thing that bothered me first off the base here was that I worked under security for 14 years. The notion that a cameraman would be able to keep rolls of what was clearly a top secret plus footage, just in 1947 especially, just doesn't make sense to me. That's not how classified stuff gets handled. They are not casual about it. And Kent Jeffrey, who's done a splendid job of gathering up some old-time cameramen, military guys, respectable guys, has found that this would violate all the rules, how the film was shot and all the rest of that. Now, what I cannot do, Art, unfortunately, is tell you that this film was made by company XYZ on January 39, 1992, at this studio. I don't have the genesis of it, but the burden isn't on me to provide that.
No smoking film canisters yet.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Stanton.
Hi.
Hi, this is Carol from Los Angeles. I spoke to you about 26 years ago when I saw a flying... yeah. When I saw a flying saucer here on off of Melrose on La Brea.
My goodness.
And you sent me papers, and I had to fill them out.
Yep.
The whole thing. You asked how big it was, and the color and the speed it when it went off, you know, when it flew off.
Yes,
the whole
and I
thing.
Did live in the area at that time.
You did?
Yes.
Yes, I know. You were either at Hermosa Beach or Manhattan
Redondo.
Beach.
Redondo.
Redondo Beach.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I remember because I had your home phone number. You had mine. We used to correspond. Now, it's such a pleasure because the only time I get to see you was when you're on sightings. You know, it's such a pleasure to see you again, to talk to you again. Listen, I want to ask you a question. You answered my question about the autopsy because I wanted to know if you thought it was real or not, you know, what they've been showing
on question?
TV. But the question I have for you, Art, also is what color... When you, Stanton, asked me what it looked like that I saw, how big it was and so forth, because it was going around but it was standing still, and it was as high as a two-story building. It was high up, I mean, not big that way.
Yes.
Okay. You asked me about that, and I told you it was the color of tin foil, but the dull side of tin foil, not the shiny side.
And?
And I wanted to know, Art, the pieces that you received in the mail.
Yes.
Was it dull or shiny?
All right. Well, the aluminum portions were fairly shiny, and the bismuth and magnesium is burned on one side. And if exposed, or if you look at a cross section of it, it is shiny. Is the answer. Took a long time to get there, though. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hi.
Good morning, Art. Long-time listener, and I must tell you that today's show has been one of the best that I've heard so far. I would like to if possible, get some information from Stan in regards to this story out of Brazil. I myself am Portuguese, speak Portuguese, and read Portuguese, and am interested in trying to obtain this story that he's referring to from there. He mentioned a magazine that featured, I believe, a six-page story
yes.
on this.
That I can tell you the name of that and the date. It's Istoe, and pardon my pronunciation, I-S-T-O-E, Istoe magazine, which is published in Sao Paulo. It was the May 22nd issue, and I can even give you an address for the magazine. I don't know the cost of the magazine, to tell you the truth. It's Rua William Spears, 1000. Strange name for a Brazilian street. Lapa, L-A-P-A, C-E-P, colon, 05067-900, Sao Paulo, S-P, that's the state for the listeners, Brazil. And that was the May 22nd issue. Now, I don't know whether that magazine might be available at foreign publications or a library in the area. I really don't know.
I have daily contact with journalists out of Brazil. This is the first I have heard of this story, so I believe I can get it directly from them. The city in which that this transpired in, I heard you mention it. I'm not familiar with the city.
Well, I may be pronouncing it wrong. It's V-A-R-G-I-N-H-A.
Virginia, okay.
Yeah, Mato Grosso, M-G.
Okay.
It's a couple hundred kilometers, I guess, west of Belo Horizonte.
Okay.
All right, does all that help you?
That sure did, and I'm hoping to get my hands on this, and if I can possibly get it, do some translation into English on it also and make it available to other people.
I would love that. You get it to me, we'll get it on the website. All
right? Certainly will. Thank you, Art.
Great.
Good evening.
Right, thank you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hello.
Hello, Art. I tell you what, this is fate that I actually got through to you. I've called so many times. This is Doug.
Okay, Doug, where are you?
In Clovis, California. I'm the G-Man. I'm thinking about changing my moniker because you never remember me.
Okay.
But anyway, I have a question, and I hope you don't think I'm nuts. Because, Art, we really have to talk, and I'm trying to arrange that. But anyway, that's another story. The question is, have you folks ever heard of the common sense theory of time? Because I think I have it.
Tell me more. I'm not sure. I've heard a lot of theories of time.
Yeah.
Art, about 6 months ago, some guy called you, and he sounded really deranged. And that's all he got out was, Art, you're going to hear about the common sense theory of time. And you asked him to explain it. And ever since then, I've thought about it, and I've actually got a common sense theory of time.
Well, if you can
I
give
really
it to us.
I really want to talk to you about
well,
it.
Well, all right, if you can give it to us quickly, go ahead.
Well, basically, I don't know. I have written some things down, and things come to me.
Okay, you're going to have to get it out here, sir, or we got to go.
Sir, basically, it's so complicated, but
all right,
it's very simple. I'll have to write you. I'm sorry.
All right, I'll look forward to that then. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Stanton.
Hi.
Just wanted to give you some information, Stanton, in regards to the Brazil thing. In February, late February, I'm down in Laughlin, Nevada. This is Clayton, Art. I saw a diesel go up on 95 heading towards Las Vegas. A flatbed on the back of it that said biological containment unit.
Great.
I love it.
So who knows where that was headed, I guess.
You didn't get a photograph, did you?
Oh, I wish I would have had a camera at the time. There were two pieces to this unit. And one, it was real big, and the other one was kind of small, and it was olive green. Couldn't tell if it was wood or plastic, but it was all framed in, tethered down, and back flap was flapping, and it was written in stencil with black.
Ah, that's interesting. All right. Stan, what do you know about what's going on here near Area 51 now? Is this still an area where things are hot or not?
Well, you know, that area has received so much attention this past couple of years, partly because of Bob Lazar and all the other noise that's been made, that I've heard rumors, what else can I say, that much of the fancy activity has been moved from there. to other locations. There are now much more remote places up in Utah and Nevada, for example, and up in Idaho. And people need to remember that was a perfectly legitimate reason for being that, using, building that secret area that was to test advanced propulsion systems.
Sure.
There was a Cold War on. We didn't want spies copying our goodies. And so, you know, stealth and the U-2 and the SR-71 and maybe Aurora and all these things. And especially interesting, the remotely piloted vehicles and, I love this name, uninhabited aerial vehicles. These things look sort of like saucers. They're very lightweight, using very sophisticated electronics. They can stay on site, so to speak, for hours, observe an enemy from a short distance, and send back real-time data for targeting missiles and all that sort of thing. And naturally, they're being tested out there, and naturally, people, because there's so many spectators around, have seen them.
Sure.
That doesn't mean they're alien spacecraft. So I don't know about anything really hot and new, other than I know when I was down in Brazil and when I was in England and France that I got asked about Area 51.
Sure. I'm sure you did. One more. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stanton Friedman. Hello.
King Arthur.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Friedman.
Mister, please, yes.
This is, all right, mister, this is Mitch, the Magic Christian, calling you from Ventura in Southern California.
Okay, yeah, I know where it is.
Another guest that Art's had on a couple of times, Stan Deo, he lives in Australia now, has talked about rotating electromagnetic fields as a propulsion system for aircraft, and he has said that in a donut configuration, that's the aircraft's configuration, that in near space we have achieved hypersonic speeds of between 35 and 40,000 miles an hour. Do you know anything about this, and would you say that this is feasible?
Not the latter part. I mean, orbital velocity is 25,000 or 18,000, so 35,000 seems sort of out of, literally off the world, out of the world. I have been writing about magneto-aerodynamic propulsion systems since the late 60s. There's an enormous amount of published in classified literature data, and of course there was an electromagnetic submarine that basically worked on the same principles. That was not magneto-aerodynamic, obviously, but if you replace one electrically conducting fluid, seawater, with ionized air, it turns out you can get around all the problems of high-speed flight. Naturally, the work was classified. I had over 900 references in a bibliography that I drew up, had done for me back in, 1969, believe it or not. So there's been a lot of work going on, and there's some very exciting work that may be related to this being done at Rensselaer Polytechnical Institute in Troy, New York, by Professor Leik, L-E-I-K, Mirabeau, M-Y-R-A-B-O, who's got facilities, sort of wind tunnel and laser and stuff, and has demonstrated some of this, and there's been quite a bit of publicity over the last year. So it's a new direction for propulsion. It doesn't work by carrying along something you throw away. It works by interacting with your surroundings. And so it's a good area for future research. Certainly we've kept the lid on whatever success we've had for obvious reasons. And the world of the future may see a lot of MAD, magneto aerodynamic, MAD systems running around up there.
All right, Stan, we are out of time. Show is over and all that sort of thing. My friend, thank you. You know we're going to stay in touch regarding these pieces and parts.
Yes.
And stay in touch, period. And then you're coming back for a Dreamland on the 14th of July.
Looking forward to it.
Take care, my friend.
Thanks.
Stanton Friedman, a nuclear physicist. That's it, everybody. We're out of time. To get a copy of the entire program you've heard this morning, and I can well imagine you may want one, you can get it to get a two-page free copy. We gave out Stan's address. I want to thank you all. We'll be back tomorrow night with Major Dames. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. Good night, America.